This is Richard Verona. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. John Hodgin. And today is February 3rd, 2003. Mr. Hodgin, you're in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and I'm in Lubbock, Texas, at the Special Collections Library in the interview room. Sir, if we could begin with some biographical information on yourself, tell us where you were born and when you were born, and a little bit about your childhood.
Well, Richard, I was born in Greensboro, North Carolina, on November the 4th, 1936. I grew up, really, high school and college in Burlington, North Carolina. Uh-huh. I went to Elon College, and from Burlington, that's where I joined the Air Force.
Okay. So you grew up in Burlington?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I lived for a couple years in Pennsylvania when my father was in the war, and then I lived for 4 years in Wilmington. Other than that, it's Burlington.
Okay. Tell me what your memories are of your childhood.
Just playing around, having fun. Uh-huh. No problem at all.
Yeah. You said your father was in the war.
No, he wasn't in the war, but he was making seaplanes up in Pennsylvania in Allentown for the Defense Department, so he didn't have to be drafted if he was doing that Defense Department work.
Okay. Were any of your other relatives involved in the war?
My brother, an older brother, was in the Navy for 4 years.
Uh-huh.
He served on a ship, and he got out, I think, just prior to the Korean conflict, so he wasn't really in a war.
Okay. He wasn't in the theater of action. He was in after the war, basically.
He was in after the Second World War and prior to the Korean War.
Okay.
So he was there during a peacetime.
Okay. How many other brothers and sisters did you have?
Okay, I've got another brother who joined the Air Force about a year after. Several years after I did, and he was stationed in. His first overseas base was over in England,
uh-huh.
And he died over there in a car wreck.
Hmm.
While I was PCS to Okinawa.
Okay.
That's the only other ones who were in the military.
Okay. Did you have any siblings who did not serve?
No, that's it.
That's it, okay.
I had a sister. She didn't serve, of course.
Okay, right. Do you have any memories of World War II as a young boy growing up in Burlington?
When I was really young, the only thing I remember when I was young in Greensboro, right after, before I moved to Burlington, was that they would come by and tell you to cut off your lights and everything because they were having these warnings, you know,
mm-hmm.
And they had blackouts so that the towns wouldn't show up.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember that. That's the only thing.
Okay.
I was really, really young then.
Right. How much contact did you have with your siblings who were in the military? The one that was older than you that had joined...
the Navy?
Yes, sir.
He would write to us now and then, and he'd come home, and I was impressed with his Navy uniform, and he gave me one of those white Navy hats that I could wear. It impressed me. In fact, I had planned on joining the Navy if I ever had to go in.
Okay. Was he a pretty big influence on you as far as joining the military?
No. No, he wasn't at all.
Okay. How about your parents? What did they do for a living?
Well, my father, back then, in fact, his whole life, was a supervisor at a hosiery mill.
Okay. And did your mother work?
No, she didn't.
Okay. Would you describe your childhood? Were you guys well off financially, or were you middle class?
No, we were middle class. I'm not sure, but it's probably a little bit lower middle class.
Okay. And you said you spent 5 years in Wilmington. Is that correct?
Yes.
Was that during your high school years?
No. That was during grade school years. My father was transferred down to a hosiery mill there.
Okay.
And it was up until the seventh grade,
okay.
From the fourth grade to the seventh grade.
Okay. And after the seventh grade, where did you guys move?
We moved to Burlington, and that's
okay.
where I ended up.
Tell tell me about your high school years. What do you remember most about them?
High school was there in Burlington. It was a new high school, Walter Williams, and really beautiful high school. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed high school. I met a lot of friends who I still meet and play around with.
Okay. Did you participate in sports?
No, I was not into sports other than ping pong.
Okay.
I ended up being a state champion ping pong player.
Oh, okay.
And I was interested in chess back then, and so didn't play any of that other stuff.
How did you become so good at ping pong?
Well, I got a job at the YMCA in Burlington, and I was running this snack bar, and there was two ping pong tables there, and I just played it every day, and we got some good players down there, and some people who were qualified to be state champions were my opponents, and I just played so much, I got good.
Uh-huh. You got good enough to be state champion.
Yeah, well, I ended up being a three state champion, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia.
Wow. Was this when you were in high school?
That was when I was last year of high school and then through college at Elon.
Okay. Were you a good student in high school?
In high school, I was better than average, not top.
Okay. What were your favorite subjects?
You mean there's a favorite subject?
what were the subjects that you could stand best, I guess?
I enjoyed the math. It was hard for me to keep the history in my mind.
Okay.
And I enjoyed the English and the languages.
Okay.
I took French in high school, and then I took Spanish in college, and and today can barely say a word or two.
Okay. Did your parents emphasize education? Was it expected for you to go to college after high school?
No. My father did not want me to go to college. I don't know why. He wanted me to, maybe he didn't want to pay for it. He wanted me to join the Army and get that over with so that I'd grow up. And then after I got out, maybe go to college.
Okay. What year did you graduate high school?
In 1955.
Okay. And did you go straight to Elon after that?
Yes.
Okay. What was that experience like for you?
I was living at home and driving over there every day, so it wasn't really like being at a college, you know. There's a difference when you're living at home in Burlington.
Right.
And Elon, of course, is only 5 miles outside of Burlington, so.
Right.
It was just kind of an extension of high school.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you go 4 years and finish?
I went 3.5 years and quit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Were you, like, one semester short of completing?
Yes.
Why did you quit?
Well, my father didn't support me for college. I had to go on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working at that time at Western Electric,
uh-huh.
night shift, loading boxcars.
Okay.
And sleeping through college.
Okay.
So I was learning nothing and doing nothing, and I didn't enjoy it. So I said, well, I'm going to sit out until I make some money and then go back and finish.
Okay.
Or not go at all. It's not doing anything for me.
Okay.
So I set out for a semester.
Okay.
And during the end of that semester, I decided, hey, I'm going to get drafted if I sit out because the draft was still going on, and I certainly don't want to be in the Army. So I ended up in the Air Force.
So you went ahead and volunteered?
Well, that's a fairly long story. But while I was at Western Electric, there was a young boy working with me who wanted to be a pilot. And he said he wanted to do it real bad and that he was going to go over and take a test to join the aviation cadets and be a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And would I go with him over to Raleigh to do that?
Okay.
And I said, no, I'm not interested in that at all. And he said, well, you know, if you take the day off and go over there, you get paid. And I said, what do you mean? Western Electric will pay me if I go over there? And they said, yeah. He said, yes, and even if you pass it, you don't have to join. I said, hey, I'll go with you.
Mm-hmm.
So we went over there. He didn't pass the test. I did. They called me and said, we'd like for you to go down to Seymour Johnson for 3 more days of tests. including a physical. And I said, no, I'm not interested in joining the Air Force. My brother was in the Navy, and I'm probably going to join there. Okay. And they said, well, you don't have to join. Even if you qualify, you still don't have to join. It's up to you. And for that 3 days, your company will pay you. Hey, you know, working on boxcars or going down there. And so they sent me down to Seymour Johnson for 3 days. I passed the test and came back, still with no intention of getting in the Air Force. Come September, when my friends started going back to school, I said, hey, I don't want to sit around here, and I don't really feel like going back to college. And so I called them up and said, okay, here I am.
Huh. Was this 1958 or 59?
I was in 59.
59, okay. And so you know what? You went ahead and enlisted?
Yes, into the Aviation Cadet Program.
Okay. And where did you go when you first enlisted?
They sent me down to San Antonio for my first part of my training, and it lasted a little less than a year, but the last 2 or 3 months probably were down at Hollingen Air Force Base.
Okay.
But the first part was down in San Antonio.
What was that initial training like for you?
It was weird. They were really tough on you, get you up against the wall every day and sit there and fuss at you for about a couple of hours. And the rest of the time was either cleaning up your room and putting everything 1 inch from each other or else outside marching.
Right. How did you deal with that military discipline?
I dealt with it very good. I think I'm a type of perfectionist anyway. I had no problem with meeting all the requirements.
Okay.
And as a matter of fact, I was probably the only one. I never marched while I was there for a penalty. That was your penalty if you did something wrong.
Uh-huh.
March for an hour or two.
Okay. And what kind of training did you have? Was it more physical and just mental, or did you have some classroom?
I had the classroom training. It was physical and mental. They taught you, you know, the Air Force policy. They taught you navigator policy because it was a navigator training. And then we had, training flights that we had to pass.
Right.
Classes of everything we had to learn. Had to learn the name of all the stars and all that stuff, you know.
Okay. How did you adapt to all that?
I enjoyed it.
Yeah?
Really. I didn't get enough sleep every night. I didn't get enough food to eat every day. But I had a lot of good friends, and I got along pretty good in that program.
Okay. What would you say was the most challenging aspect of that training?
Most challenging was, I don't know what the most challenging was. Probably the physical part of it.
Okay. Now, had you wanted to fly? Did you have a desire to fly before?
No, never had a desire to fly. I wasn't scared of it. It's just there's no interest there.
Right. How did you deal with your first flights? What was it like for you?
They were interesting and hard. I had a hard time figuring out where we were. I think throughout my life I had that same problem.
Now, were you training to be a navigator?
Yes, navigator. Okay. The reason was when I was down in Seymour Johnson getting my physicals, they had discovered astigmatism in my eyes and said that I did not qualify to be a pilot because of my eyes.
Okay.
So I was accepted as a navigator.
Now, as a navigator, able to improve upon your lack of direction or finding out where you were?
Throughout the years I did, I learned that if a pilot ever asks you where you are, don't ever say, I don't know. Say, 50 feet left of course, and, you know, that makes them feel good. Although, deep inside, you have no idea where you are.
Okay. So, when you went to Harlingen, did you do more flight training there?
Yes, and I did some more there, and that was the final part where we graduated.
Okay. And this was in 1960?
Yes.
Okay. And from Harlingen, where did you go?
Harlingen, they gave me orders when we graduated to go to B-52 training.
Mm-hmm.
And I was ranked 13th in a class of, I don't know, about 250 people. And then they got some operational assignments down at the head of the field, and they didn't know how to do it, so they called us all into an auditorium and said, we're going to take away all of your assignments, and we'll start all over, and we're going to go down by class ranking and let you pick where you want to go. They didn't do this before because people didn't enjoy B-52s, and B-52 people were at the bottom of the class always, and the Air Force didn't like that. But anyway, for this particular one, since they got the operational assignments, they went down the list. And when it came to me, there was an assignment to Pope, North Carolina. I had no idea what kind of airplanes or anything, but it was North Carolina, and I took it.
Okay. What planes had you been training in up to this point?
Those T-29s.
Okay. So when you go to Pope, what were you trained in?
The Pope had C-123s. And they had moved over, I don't know, a few years before that from C-119s, but they had C-123s, which were propeller-driven airplanes that had no pressurization, so you couldn't go too high.
Right. And these were more transport supply aircraft?
Transports, yes.
Mm-hmm. This is in 1961 or 60?
That was in September of 1960 when I arrived at Pope.
Okay. And were you able to see your family at all when you went back to North Carolina?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was the good part of it. I was so close to them. Mm-hmm. I was within an hour and a half drive to my family.
Were they supportive of you being in the military at this point?
Yeah, they enjoyed that. They were impressed that I was an officer.
Huh, okay. Okay. So tell me what your training at Pope was like. You were trained as a navigator in the C-123s?
Yes, I was. Our usual missions were we'd fly maybe 3 or 4 days a week, and we'd fly hour and a half course around to the Fort Bragg drop zones, drop out these paratroopers, and come on back. It was map reading around and drop them out and come back. Uh-huh. And we did that most of the time. We'd go with TDY down to Panama and on weekend trips sometime to Bermuda or down to Puerto Rico, but our daily routine was usually dropping the paratroopers.
Okay. And how did you find it? Were you getting better at becoming a navigator, or was it difficult?
Yeah, I fit in. I wasn't outstanding. I wasn't bottom. I just fit in pretty good. I was, the newest person at Pope, and they didn't get many second lieutenants there. So I was learning stuff as I was going on.
What would you do down in Panama? You said you went down there?
We went down there and we dropped, it was Army exercise. We dropped, a week or two, we dropped paratroopers on some drop zones down there.
Okay. So you're mainly hauling men around?
Yeah, hauling men around mostly. Sometimes we just haul cargo around.
Okay. How long were you at Pope?
Oh, until I retired.
Okay, so that was your home base, basically.
That was my home base, but I was overseas a lot, probably more than I was back at Pope, but that was the only stateside base after my cadets that I ever was at.
Huh. Okay. So tell me what happened as far as where was your first deployment, serious overseas deployment, while you were at Pope?
Well, that was for the ranch hand.
Okay.
And
what year was that?
Let's see there. That was in 1962.
Okay. And were you going to be flying C-123?
No, it was we took off in November of 61, but we didn't get to Vietnam until 62.
Okay. Was this in C-123s?
Yes.
Okay. And can you describe what that was like when you went overseas and how you felt about that?
It started out, we were picked. People came down from Air Force and picked some volunteers to go over there. I remember I had a meeting with the wing commander. He talked to all of these volunteers for about 5 minutes and told us that wanted to know if we volunteered for a top secret mission, and that and he said something like, if you get shot down, the country may even say that they you were acting on your own accord, and it's where you're going, you can't tell anyone, including your family. And it was really interesting to me, and so I said, sure, I volunteered, just because it was exciting.
Uh-huh.
And so he said, okay, well, where you're going to be going, if you're selected, is to South Vietnam. Well, I had heard the word South Vietnam, but it's like Djibouti. You have no idea where it is.
Uh-huh.
So I went home, looked it up in the encyclopedia, and it said, you know, they have monsoons, and they have rubber, and they do this, and it's in Indochina. So it didn't impress me.
Now, had you been keeping up with U.S. policy and kind of our slow evolution of involvement in Southeast Asia?
No. I had no idea other than the name South Vietnam.
Okay.
I had no idea what they were doing. I didn't learn until after I got over there and started studying about Dien Bien Phu and all of that other stuff.
Okay. How much did the Air Force tell you about what you were doing?
At that time, where I was going and everything?
Yes, sir.
Zero.
Hmm. And it was deemed a top secret mission?
Yes.
How many people volunteered?
I'm probably guessing around 50. I don't know, counting the pilots.
Okay.
And so they came down, and they needed, they were going to send six airplanes over, and back then it was called Operation Farmgate, later changed to Ranch Hand.
Mm-hmm.
Six airplanes over, and they wanted six navigators, and one would stay over there, and the other five would come back. Because they only needed one navigator to lead the formations over there.
Okay.
And they gave us all check rides and tests and everything. And I was chosen to be the one to stay over there. I don't know why. Maybe because I wasn't married.
Okay.
I was impressed being a second lieutenant going over there and being the navigator chosen. But that's the way it was. And they told us later on that we would be running spray missions.
How long after you'd been there did they tell you this?
They told us before we left, but it was secret and we weren't allowed to tell anybody. And, of course, when we left with the spray planes, we had all the stuff there already.
Right. How do they describe the spraying to you? What do they tell you about that?
Before we did it?
Yes, sir.
They just said, you're going to go over there for 2 or 3 months and test spraying some jungles to see if we can get a better view of the enemy when they walk through it. And I said, okay.
Okay. Did they tell you what was behind that, exactly what would happen to the vegetation and things like that?
No, and I'm not even sure they knew.
Huh.
They, you know, before that, they'd sprayed mosquitoes with that outfit.
Right.
So we didn't know when we were going over there other than we were going to be spraying the jungle.
Okay. Were they giving you combat pay for this, or was this just another?
No, it wasn't.
Because we weren't technically at war, but...
No, we were not even supposed to be over there. You know, the Geneva Convention said you could only have, 800 and some people over there.
Yes, sir.
And they were sneaking all these people over there. So we weren't even allowed to say that we were over there. We couldn't even write home and say we're over there. And when we were over there, we were assisting the Vietnamese. We weren't doing our own job, is what they said.
Okay. How did you guys actually get over to South Vietnam? Did you fly the 123s over?
Oh, yeah. That was an interesting thing. We took off from Pope the day after Thanksgiving, 1961. And we were going to fly all the way over to Travis Air Force Base, California. The 123s couldn't fly that far. They couldn't even fly probably to Texas without stopping to refuel.
Right.
And so they used that spray tank inside to have the gasoline in it. And since they didn't have enough oil, they added a 55-gallon oil drum inside that you could hand crank to put oil in the engines. And the first test of that was to see if we could make it all the way to California.
Okay.
And we did. And that was a long flight. But the longest flight was supposed to have been the one after that when we went to Hawaii, which was supposed to be around 17 hours of flying.
Mm-hmm.
It ended up 17 and a half hours, but it was really interesting.
What were your duties there on board the plane?
I was the navigator.
Mm-hmm.
When we were going... since 17 hours is a long time for anyone to navigate,
right,
they switched it off, and we'd fly formation, and the navigator from one of the adjacent planes would navigate the whole group for a while, and then I'd navigate it for a while.
Okay. And where did you sit in the plane? What was the C-123 cockpit and all that like?
The cockpit, the C-123 had the pilot and the co-pilot up there, and the navigator seat, navigator sat down in the cargo compartment for takeoff, and soon as after takeoff, he got up to a seat that had been added way up at the top of the cargo compartment, front of the cargo compartment, with a desk up there, way up there, and a seat that turned around and would fit into the doorway of where the pilot and co-pilot sat, so you could use their instruments, and you had some instruments too.
So you were very close to the co-pilot and pilot.
Yeah, I could, I'm a little bit further than just reaching out and touching them, probably.
Okay. So you had good communication with them, and
yes,
and you could see all the instrument panels that you
yes.
needed to. Okay. So when you arrived in Hawaii, did you just refuel and take a night's sleep and take off again? Or?
Yeah, that's what we did. And from Hawaii, we flew to Johnson Island down, off of Hawaiian Island.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then from there up to Wake Island,
okay.
then over to Guam and then to the Philippines.
Okay. And were you based out of Clark in the Philippines?
Based out of Clark, and when we got there, they didn't have the permission for us to go into Vietnam, and so we sat there for over a month, doing nothing.
Really?
Other than we'd go and practice spray flights without spray and just formation.
Right.
To have something to do.
Okay. What was your formation like? What were the tactics like there in spraying?
Well, we would fly at 150 feet, 130 knots, or somewhere in that area, and try to stay in formation so that we wouldn't leave gaps in the spray if we were spraying.
Okay.
Since we weren't spraying, we had no idea whether we had gaps or not. Then we'd practice what would happen if someone were to lose an engine or that, and we practiced everything, but we really had no idea whether that was what we should be practicing or not, because no one had ever done it before.
How much defoliant would each plane carry?
Well, when we were in Clark, of course, we carried no defoliant.
Right.
After we had the tank was held 1,000 gallons.
Okay.
And when we'd spray, that's how much we would carry.
Okay. And about how long was your run spraying that? How long
when we were spraying, the actual spray run, I'm guessing would be around 6 or 7 minutes. It wasn't long at all.
Okay.
And we would go back and forth. We had to double spray it because we only put out a gallon per acre, and we needed, a gallon and a half per acre, but we needed twice that much to get the kill the trees over there.
Okay. Did they give you any other training, like survival training, in case you were shot down?
No. I went to the, before I went over there, I was even selected, I went to the survival training class down at Nellis, close to Las Vegas,
mm-hmm.
That everybody goes to. It had nothing to do with going to Vietnam.
Okay. So did you feel pretty prepared just in case anything like that happened?
No, I didn't feel like I was not prepared or prepared. I just felt like it was another mission.
Okay.
I wasn't worried about a war over there. I really wasn't.
What did they tell you about what was happening inside the country?
They just said that, the Viet Cong were fighting against the Vietnamese, and we were going to advise the Vietnamese on how to do it. There was really no emphasis put on us getting shot at or getting shot down.
Okay. President Kennedy was the president at this time.
Oh, yes.
And what did you think of President Kennedy and his policies?
You're trying to get me to say whether I'm a Democrat or a Republican.
No, sir.
I thought President Kennedy was exciting president, and I enjoyed him a lot.
Okay. And I'm leading up to really the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 62. You were at Clark at this point, is that
no,
right?
No, when they had that missile crisis, I was already in Vietnam. That was early 62. I went over there. I got to Vietnam in January of 62.
Okay. So you were actually based in Vietnam.
No, no. I see. Yeah, I was in Vietnam when the missile crisis happened because I remember that. Uh-huh. We had gone in. We were going to fly that morning. We'd gone in to get our... at a second advance to get our intelligence briefing, and everybody was glued around the radio. And I think it's when Kennedy was making his speech mm-hmm. about that, and everybody was worried that we were going to have this nuclear crisis and that maybe the Soviets were going to start a war and then bomb us.
Right.
All I remember about that, I was saying, oh, boy, I'm glad I'm here in Vietnam. They won't bomb here.
You're probably right.
Yeah.
Okay, so were you based in Clark when you were doing all your spray missions, or did you?
No, I was based over there in Saigon. Okay. We just stayed at Clark a month or so until they got approval for our airplanes to move over to Saigon.
Okay. Do you remember who they had to get approval from?
I had heard, but I don't know, that it was the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Okay. Okay. So you moved over to Saigon. Tell me what it was like when you first got into Saigon, and what were your impressions of the country and what was happening?
Well, they had, since we were still kind of secret outfit, they parked us down in President Ziem's parking lot. It was way off base where you couldn't get off of the main runway part where you couldn't get to unless you had permission.
Right.
And so they parked their airplane. I think we only took three of them over there to start with. They parked us over there. And Vietnam, to me, when I got out, I noticed that it was hot. And I figured it was going to stay that way. Mm-hmm. They put the enlisted people in tents over there. They didn't have much anything for the military at Saigon. They had a mess hall, another office building for the people who ran the place, and then they had all these this tent city for the enlisted people.
Okay.
We were told to go downtown and find hotels or apartments and live on our own. So on the way down, I noticed the Vietnamese people were, you know, smaller of stature,
mm-hmm.
stature, and the girls wore those Ao Dais, which were nice-looking dresses,
mm-hmm.
and they all looked... they looked good, intelligent, and they were nice and friendly. I enjoyed them.
Okay. Did the government pay for your lodging and all that?
Yes, they did.
Okay.
We were TUI, so they gave us an extra, our regular pay, plus an extra $16 a day, which back then was really something else.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a lot to go with because, you know, the whole hotel or where we stayed, the apartment, cost practically nothing. In fact, going down and drinking a beer was only 9 cents.
Wow.
Eventually, after we got over there, it went up to 15 cents.
still a bargain, it sounds
yeah.
like. Did you take all the markings off the planes?
Well, no. They were going to do that, and they talked about it a lot. But they said, you know, the Vietnamese don't have any of these airplanes. It'll be kind of dumb because... they will know that it's our airplane, even if we put their markings on it. So we didn't take the markings off. But we did have. We couldn't fly unless we had a Vietnamese on board who was going to be the person that was flying the airplane,
right.
And we were advising them.
Okay.
Although, since the Vietnamese pilots were so scarce, it never was a pilot, and they always said in the back. At the last part, it was just some young soldier who... had never flown on an airplane before, and I usually just threw up.
Really?
I can imagine what it'd be like if we had crashed and we had said, well, we were just assisting this Vietnamese pilot, and it was that young guy, you know?
Uh-huh.
But that we had to do that to fill in the blanks.
Right. Tell me a little bit about where you lived in Saigon and your impressions of the city.
Well, I went there many different tours. The first one, I lived... in the Votan Hotel down there.
Uh-huh.
And while I was there, I was second lieutenant. While I was there, I made first lieutenant and rented the roof and had a party, rented a band, and had a catered service for all my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole thing cost me $100.
Wow.
Yeah, which was a lot of money for me.
Right, right. Is this when you first arrived, or?
No, that was I made first lieutenant in March of '62, and of course I arrived in January of '62. So it was a couple months after I'd been there.
Okay. So you lived in this hotel.
Yeah.
Okay, and were you the only one there, or did you have?
No, I had. Three or four other people that was sharing, I think, two bedrooms.
Okay. How much did it cost? Do you remember?
No, I have no idea.
Okay.
It couldn't have been much.
Right. Did you have service from the local Vietnamese citizens? Did they, you know, make your beds and cook for you and things like that?
Since it was a hotel, I think the hotel made the beds. And I don't remember that. Maybe we told them not to.
Uh-huh.
But all the times after that, I always had a maid.
Okay. And what were your initial impressions of Saigon, the city?
Saigon City was beautiful. Back then, when we first got there, most of the things were run by the French. They slowly backed out until there were none of them left. But the restaurants, the bars, were mostly owned by French.
Mm-hmm. What would you do for entertainment there?
No. We would meet... downtown at a restaurant, have dinner, usually a French restaurant,
mm-hmm.
and then hit four or five bars. That's it.
Okay. And the Vietnamese civilians, you said they were relatively friendly to you?
Oh, they were very nice. Very friendly, very nice, very intelligent.
Okay. Okay. So tell me exactly, like a typical day for you. What was your typical day?
Well, it was hard to have, when we first got there, we had to have so much approval before we would do a spray run that we went long times without spraying. And so sometimes I would be just the duty officer who stayed down at the squadron to answer the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I would be back at the hotel with nothing to do and go visit around Saigon. And only exciting parts, I guess, were when we would fly the missions.
Okay. Tell me about your mission days. What were they like?
Well, the first mission we had was to practice the spray run down just south of Saigon on Highway 15. Our commander, who was Captain Marshall, and Captain Robinette and myself as the navigator,
mm-hmm.
Flew down there and... practice the spray runs to see, they were going to test it to see whether it really worked or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, flying that low was interesting and a little scary, but I got used to it. Mm-hmm. And there was no one shot at us, no one did anything, it was just really nice.
Mm-hmm.
So we did, that was my first mission, and that was on 13 January 1962.
Okay.
And,
you want to continue talking about what the spray missions were like themselves? When you finished your practice runs, you actually started spraying more relevant areas of the jungle in the area?
While we were still practicing
mm-hmm.
our spray runs, before we went into the actual defoliation part, is when we lost our first airplane.
Mm, what happened?
It was in February of '62, February 2nd. I went down to the squadron,
mm-hmm.
and I was supposed to fly with Fergus Groves and Larson on a practice spray run south of Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went into the squadron, the Captain Marshall was over talking to some civilians, and he called me over there, and he said, John, I know you're supposed to fly with Groves and Larson, but... these people are from Life magazine, and they want to take some pictures of the Delta, and they need a navigator to show them around. So could you fly with, I think it was Captain Haggerty,
mm-hmm.
With him, and Groves and Larson can fly their spray run on their own. I said, okay, fine. I went with the Life photographers, And we went, they wanted to go down to the Delta. I thought maybe if I were a photographer, I'd rather take a picture of the mountains. But they went down there and they took the sun rising off of the Mekong River and, mm-hmm. and some beautiful shots around there. We were circling. And then one of them pointed out to the distance there and said, "What's that big pile of smoke over there?" And I said, "I don't have any idea. You want to go over there?" And they said, "Yeah, it may be a hamlet on fire." So I told the pilots to go over there where the smoke was.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got over there, all we saw was a crumbled airplane on the ground.
Mm.
And we could see by the tail number that it was one of ours and that it was my crew, the ones I was supposed to fly with that day.
Wow.
And, you know, that was, I just had to sit down and sit there. We stayed over it. It was burning pretty good. We stayed over it until the helicopter came down and checked it for survivors, and all of them were dead, and we went on back and landed at Saigon, and it was a bad thing since that was my crew, and I was supposed to have been on it.
Right. What happened? Do you know?
Well, they still don't know. They never found any bullet holes or that it was shot by the enemy. My personal opinion is it was a pilot error and it crashed. But they're still listed as uncertain.
Okay. Now, they had a navigator on board, didn't they?
No.
In your place? So
no, I was the only navigator there, and I only flew in the lead airplanes.
Okay.
The rest of them followed.
Okay.
And they wouldn't even fly if I was sick. I had to be on it. But when they were doing their practice runs, they didn't need a navigator at all.
Okay. Okay. Why do
that
you
was,
think, go ahead.
That was just for the navigator was just for the actual runs.
Okay.
And he had to be in the lead airplane.
Why do you say pilot error? What leads you to believe that?
It was a very hard mission, and you would almost stall out every time you'd make a turn.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just learning how to do that. And talking it over with the other pilots, we kind of felt like they stalled it out, and they were too low to the ground to level it out.
Okay.
But, you know, that's just personal opinion. I don't want to get into it. When they had the investigation, they didn't see any enemy contact.
Okay. Okay. Any other incidents happen when you guys were practicing?
Yeah, well, since it was so long between spray runs, they took the spray nozzles and the tank out of a couple of our airplanes and put us hauling cargo back and forth because they needed so many people to haul cargo.
Mm-hmm.
I went down to the squadron to fly with Captain Overman and his navigator, Wally Frankson.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a mission to go to... I think it was to Dong Ha. It was anyway, it was way north of Hue,
mm-hmm.
which was a long flight, and I really didn't feel up to it. But I looked at my log and found that I had, because I'd been flying those cargo missions so much, I'd already gone over my limit, which is okay in Vietnam. You can do that. It's no problem. But I went to our commander and told him that... hey, I was over my flying time, and why don't I just stay home for this one? And Overman, who was the pilot, said, okay, we don't need you. And Frankson, who was his co-pilot, said, hey, I used to be a navigator. We can find that. All we got to do is go to Hue and follow the railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, okay. And so I went on home, you know, and they took off and went up there. Anyway, I got a call from our commander and said, put on your flying suit and come on down. Frankson and Overman have crashed. And so I went down. We went up to Hue and took a helicopter up. What happened is they had got lost,
mm-hmm.
Landed at the wrong runway, and it was too short for them. But when they realized it was the wrong runway, they... tried to take off, and there was a mound of dirt at the end that they didn't have enough time, and they hit that mound of dirt, and it put them up in the air, and they slammed down onto the ground, and didn't hurt anybody other than tore the airplane completely up. It was gone.
Mm.
So I was thinking, there's six airplanes, two of them gone, already, and they're both of them the ones I'm supposed to be on. You know, I'm sure I like this.
Right.
So that happened.
So they both survived that crash.
Yeah, they with no injuries at all.
Hmm. Seems like you had a lucky streak there going.
Yeah, it looked like it was going getting pretty lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, that's about all happened on that first tour. Other than I was I woke up one morning to a bunch of gunfire,
mm-hmm.
and I went outside into the patio of the hotel there. At their place, and there were the policemen down below who were the ones who were acting instead of the stoplights tell you to go here and go there.
Yes, sir.
Were shooting up in the air, and I looked up there, and there was a couple airplanes flying, dropping bombs, and there was anti-aircraft fire shooting at them, and there was bullets hitting the top of our the buildings around there that I could hear and go clink, clink. And I was thinking, what in the world's going on?
Mm-hmm.
So I jumped into my clothes and went down to and got a taxi and went over to the base and ran into my squadron there and said, what's going on here? And some guy said, hey, they're having a coup d'etat.
Mm-hmm.
And being a young lieutenant, I said, what's a coup d'etat? And they were, two fighters had bombed the palace there. They didn't get Notenzium, but... they had torn up the palace pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Your first tour from January 62 to January 63?
First tour was, that was all TDY. That first tour was from, we left in here, the States in November of 61 and came back to the States in June of 62.
Okay.
But that's including spraying locusts in Afghanistan and Iran.
Okay, all right. Well, before we get there, tell me, what did you know about the South Vietnamese politics? Did you know?
I know very much now. That time, I didn't know anything other than the fact from talking to the Vietnamese, mm-hmm. which I enjoyed. They did not like Notin Ziem at all,
mm-hmm.
but what they really hated was his brother, Notin Nu, who mm-hmm. ran the secret police,
right.
and his brother's wife, Madame Nu,
mm-hmm.
who was acting as Notin Ziem's first lady.
Do you remember what they said about them?
They didn't like them at all. They hated them.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't talk about it, but I had the impression that they liked Ho Chi Minh.
Really? What led you to that conclusion?
Well, they would talk about if we had only had an election and Ho Chi Minh had been the president, we'd been a better country. And, you know, Notin Ziem also, being Catholic, most of the people there, 85% or so, were Buddhists.
Right.
So, they didn't like each other. They didn't get around each other very much.
Hmm. Did you get a sense that the civilian population there understood the differences between communism and democracy and things like that?
No, I don't think that... They were for nationalism. Anybody that wants to unite a country, and they are part of our country other than being French or Japanese or American, mm-hmm. we're for,
mm-hmm.
And you can't blame them for that. No matter where you're from, you love your country.
Mm-hmm. So you sense a deep love for the country first.
Yeah, the love for the country first.
Okay. What other impressions of the civilians did you have? You obviously had some time to talk with them.
Yes.
Where was this, at the bars or...?
At the bars everywhere. I would, even the Ciclo drivers, the pedicab drivers, we would talk, the taxi drivers or other people. Plus, I was trying to learn some Vietnamese, and so I wanted to talk to them anyway,
Uh-huh. Did you try to practice Vietnamese?
Oh, yeah, and I even got books and studied it, but, overall, it ended up only being pidgin English.
Okay.
Pidgin Vietnamese.
Okay. So... tell me, you said sometimes you had a long wait between your spray missions.
Yes.
What would you do? You said you went on base and...
I took tennis lessons at the Vietnamese Country Club.
Mm-hmm.
I went and played duplicate bridge over at the French Country Club, mm-hmm. La Cercle Sportif, which was an interesting place I'll get to later.
Okay.
And... to seeing if I could hit every bar in Saigon and every restaurant in Saigon and the nightclubs.
Uh-huh. Did you have any particular favorite bars or restaurants?
Oh, yeah. The ones down on what they call Catanat, which was Tudor, later changed to Tudor Street, mm-hmm. were probably the most famous. They were probably the ones we went to most.
Okay.
They were closest to the best restaurants anyway, and walking distance from the restaurants. That's probably why we went there.
Right. What was your favorite food while you'd been there?
French. Only French. Boy, I just love French food.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd get in there and eat French bread, French onion soup, and a nice filet mignon, something. Mm-hmm. You could be. I didn't care for Vietnamese food.
Really?
And I really couldn't stand that fish sauce they use.
The Nook Mom.
Nook Mom, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, Lord, it was horrible. In fact, I threatened, when I was over there on a second or third tour, my maid who would cook it up in her kitchen, mm-hmm. that I was going to fire her if she didn't wait until after I ate before she even got that stuff open.
Really? Huh. What would you do as far as getting news from the United States? Were you able to find out what was happening back home?
No, it was usually late. It was usually straight from the Stars and Stripes.
Mm-hmm.
If there were anything happening, like, you know, the missile crisis or anything, we'd find out kind of immediately from the intelligence people. But other than that, it was just late from the Stars and Stripes. I don't recall even having a radio or if there was an English station.
How about contact with your family? Were you riding back and forth to your parents?
No, we couldn't.
Oh, that's right.
We couldn't to start with.
Mm-hmm.
For that first tour, I think during the middle of that first tour, they relented and said, you can write your folks, but don't tell them anything mm-hmm. about what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So we did write back. I wrote a couple letters just to say, hello, I'm still doing fine.
Okay. So before you left Vietnam in June 62 or a little bit before?
Well, let's see. When I left, I departed Saigon on 2 May of 62, but instead of going straight back to the States, they sent us over to Iran to spray locusts.
Okay. What was that experience like?
Well, from Saigon, we went over to Calcutta, India, and then over to Karachi, Pakistan, and then over to Tehran, Iran, and we sprayed locusts down in the Kermanshah Valley,
mm-hmm.
which is southwest of Tehran,
mm-hmm.
and stayed there, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks before, and then when that was finished, they sent us from there over to Kandahar,
mm-hmm.
Which is famous now, but wasn't then, Kandahar, Afghanistan,
right.
Which was back then owned by the Soviets, and we would buy our gas from the Soviets, and
mm-hmm.
and they were over there spraying too.
Okay, what were they spraying?
They were spraying locusts at the same time, but they had a small bi-wing airplane, but they weren't spraying; they were dropping pellets or dust or something that would instead of us. We were spraying with spray. That, in my opinion, was completely ineffective. I think it dissolved before it ever got to the ground.
Really? How far off the ground were you spraying?
I don't know, but if you wanted to guess, I'd say around 1,000 feet.
Okay.
But it was, you know, over their wheat crops, which were just being completely torn up by those locusts.
Mm-hmm.
The locusts would come over, and it would just be like a big cloud coming over. The whole place would get dark.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen so many grasshoppers.
Was it effective at all?
No.
How about in Iran?
No.
Okay. Were you able to spend any time on the ground?
Yeah.
In these various places?
At Tehran, we spent a lot of time over there on the ground, and in Afghanistan too. We lived down at the USAID compound, and we stayed there for a couple of weeks or a month. I don't know.
What was Iran like?
Iran was, back then it was, the Shah.
Yes, sir.
Shah Pahlavi, was that his name?
I believe so.
Was running the country, and it was no problem at all as far as Americans went. We weren't allowed to spray in our we had to take the rank off of our uniforms, and we wore these black fur hats like those Russians will wear.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you wear the markings on the airplanes?
No, we kept the USA markings on the airplanes. Yeah.
Okay.
And lived downtown hotel in Tehran. Then we went over to Afghanistan. We lived down at the USAID mission.
What were the Iranians like, the civilian population?
They mostly ignored us. A couple people went out of their way to say, hey, I'm glad to meet you, an American. But as a general rule, the others could care less. Mm. It was not a very friendly place, but they weren't enemies like they probably are now.
What about the Afghan people?
Same. The women, you didn't know if it was a woman or a man.
Right.
Because they had on all that stuff that you couldn't see anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then the men were no different from the Iranians as far as I go. But they were not friendly. They just didn't want to talk to you.
Okay. Were you able to travel in the cities, walking around the cities into the
markets? Oh, yes. That was no problem. And I went down and I would go to the shops. And I even bought a gold Russian coin from one of those people. He had it hidden up under some stuff, and he only showed it to me because I was an American.
Uh-huh.
But they'd have the places where they'd sell fruit and stuff, you know.
Right. You were obviously out of uniform.
Yes.
Okay.
We went around in civilian clothes. In fact, we did that everywhere, and if we weren't flying.
Okay. So after you hit Afghanistan and Iran, you came on back to the States?
Right. We came on back to the States by way of France and the Azores and that, which ended up being the only C-123 who ever flew around the world.
Hmm. Okay. So did you have any, how was your navigation skills? Were they improving?
They were improving a lot flying around the world.
Right, I can imagine.
Yeah. And I was pretty slick at navigation by then.
Okay. So when you went straight back to Pope, is that correct?
Yeah, and arrived there, I think, in June of 62.
Okay.
June, and about 2.5 months later in September, I took off again.
Did you have to volunteer again to go?
Yeah. I volunteered to go back to Vietnam to spray again.
Did they come, you know, pick you out and say, you know,
yeah,
Lieutenant Hodgin, you've had a lot of experience?
Yes, they the pilots from Langley called me and said, hey, we're going again. Why don't you go with us? And I said, fine. And so we went.
Mm-hmm.
And each time we'd go, it would be for 6 months.
Okay.
And it would be TDY.
Okay. How many of these did you go on?
Oh, I went on, I think, about four. Then at one time I was PCS over there.
Okay. So initially you went these first four TDYs, you went for 6 months each?
Yes.
Okay, those were almost back-to-back. What did you do when you got back to North Carolina? How long you had, what, 3 months or so before you went back? What did you do at Pope?
Well, when I got back to the first time to North Carolina, we I don't think I did anything other than just what we usually do, carry the Army around.
Were you able to go back to Burlington and visit your folks?
Yeah, I took a couple weeks leave, and so I'd probably, other than that, it was only about a month or so before I had to go back over there.
Okay.
And I remember my mother saying, hey, I don't care what happens, just don't go to Vietnam.
Were you able to tell her?
I told her I was going on the second one, but after that I would tell her I was going to the Philippines.
Okay. Did they ever know you were in Vietnam those initial few years?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they did. After I got back from the first one, it was no secret anymore and we could tell.
Okay. And your mother was worried, I take it.
Oh, yeah.
Why was she worried more about South Vietnam?
Well, back after the second tour, around the second tour, that's when the Americans started getting killed over there, and she was worried about it because it was in the news, you know.
Right. Okay. How about your father?
It was your job to do, you do it.
Okay. More practical.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you went back in September 62, was it basically the same routine? You stayed in Saigon at the hotel? And
in September 62, I didn't stay in the hotel. I went down to the French bar there. I was staying in a hotel a couple nights with another guy in another guy's room because I had to look for a place to stay.
Uh-huh.
And the rest of the people were staying in an apartment, usually at 62 Tran Hung Dao. But I was going to try to get an apartment. I went into this bar, and there was a bar girl there who was living with a special forces guy. And she said, since I'm living with him, my apartment is empty. Why don't you let me rent it to you? So I rented an apartment from a bar girl.
Okay.
And I stayed stayed there for this second tour and the third tour.
Okay. What was that apartment like? Do you remember it?
Yes, it was a kitchen. There was an outside room for a maid that was before you go inside.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you go inside, there was a kitchen, a bathroom, and a living room, bedroom together. So, you know, it's kind of a small thing.
Mm-hmm. Had Saigon changed any since you'd last been there?
No. There were so many more Americans there.
Really?
And they'd built so many more things. You know, they had an American movie theater that they'd rented from the Vietnamese. They had all these American officers' club downtown and the hotel Rex, and they had the enlisted billets down there and everything now that didn't have before.
Mm-hmm. Did you talk to a lot of Americans, or did you try to hang out more with the Vietnamese people? Or
I hung out with my crew members from my squadron.
Okay.
And a lot of that was talk. And we had some, you know, Vietnamese pilot friends and all like that. But we did the same stuff as we did before.
Okay.
And I remember I was sitting at my apartment that I'd rented from that girl, sitting outside. Before we'd sprayed that day, and when I went home, my pilot said, "Hey, I'm going to a movie. You want to go with me?" And I said, "No, I'll skip the movie, but I'll meet you for supper." And we were going to meet at Atterby's restaurant downtown Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
Later, that thing got grenaded, but that's where we liked to eat.
Mm.
So he went to a movie, and I went home. I got the next-door neighbor came in and said, "Hey, have you heard about they blew up the movie?" And I said, "What?" So I jumped in a taxi and went down to the movie, and I couldn't get close to it. It was blocked off,
mm-hmm.
and people were running around asking for blood. But I couldn't get over there. So I said, "Well, let me go on over to Atterby's and see if my pilot, my friend, Charlie Haggerty, is hopefully not in that movie, you know."
Mm-hmm.
So I sat down at the bar and waited. It seemed like about an hour or two later, Charlie came in and sat down beside me.
Mm-hmm.
And we were silent there for a minute, and then I looked at him and said, "How's the movie?" You know, he said, "I don't know. I didn't get to see all of it." So anyway, he said that he'd been in the balcony of the movie when someone had run in with a bomb and set it down there, killed three or four Americans and wounded a couple dozen, and the whole roof fell in, the sides busted out, and he carried some wounded person out, and that was it. And he wasn't hurt at all being in the balcony.
Hmm.
So I think he was lucky there, too, you know.
Yes, sir. Did you guys understand what was happening, why they were actually bombing the movie theaters?
Yes, but being young, we could have cared less, you know. All you care about is what you're going to do the next hour.
Mm-hmm. Why were they bombing the theaters, in your opinion?
They didn't like Americans. Mm-hmm. They didn't like anybody who was against the nationalization of Vietnam.
You talking about the Viet Cong or just the South?
Well, obviously it had to be Viet Cong. It couldn't be South Vietnamese. And, you know, being a Viet Cong, you can walk down the streets just as easy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did it scare you guys to kind of think twice about going out? Or
when we go into a bar, we'd have to look to make sure, because they were hand grenading the bars.
Right.
We had to look to make sure there was a, we'd sit toward the back and make sure that there was a kitchen kind of thing we could run into to get out the back door if somebody threw one in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We'd start thinking of things like that. And the restaurant's the same way.
Did you try to sit closer to those back doors?
Yes.
Okay. Did other Americans do the same thing?
I didn't notice them.
Hmm. Okay. What was the mood on the streets like? Was it getting more and more tense, or was it? Did it look like Saigon as normal?
I think it looked as normal.
Okay.
The hate for the president increased, though.
Let's talk a little bit about your spray missions.
Tell me
exactly, you know, how your day would go when you had your spray mission and it went through.
Well,
and where you were spraying.
We found out that if we sprayed during the middle of the day, the temperature was so hot that the spray wouldn't even reach the ground. It would usually just rise and drift off. So we could not spray above 85 degrees. Well, since the normal temperature is above 90 in Saigon and down in the Delta,
mm-hmm.
we ended up knowing that we had to spray from when the daylight started until about no later than about 10 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
Because after that the temperature rose too much. We also found that we couldn't spray if the winds were blowing pretty good. Anything over 10 knots was too much. So the early morning spray flights were the only things we could do because of the temperature and the winds.
Mm-hmm.
And since we only sprayed in the mornings, we had the rest of the day off, and a lot of those other Americans there were wondering if we ever had a job because we were just sitting around all day, you know.
Right.
But so that's the way we would do it.
Okay.
Straight in the morning.
Okay. Where would you go to spray? Did it vary, obviously? Or?
Well, I was there before they started spraying way up north.
Mm-hmm.
Ours was mainly in the Delta.
Okay.
And we would spray the canals and the roads and around areas like that.
Okay.
We did, on one mission, I think, spray the mountains of Quinyan, other than that, which was a scary flight for me. Other than that, it was usually in the Delta.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the Quinyan flight.
Well, it was up and down mountains, and the airplane was practically stalling out every time we'd get to the bottom of the mountain and start up the other side.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't enjoy it. I always, at every run, I thought we were going to crash.
Hmm.
You know, I told the pilot that at the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Not during?
Huh?
Not during the flight?
No. I was just holding on.
Right. So you... Would the plane stall because you were going so slow to spray?
Well, it would stall because of an abrupt pull-up at the end of the spray flight,
mm-hmm.
I mean end of the run, because if you turned around and came back the other way, you wanted to know where the spray was, so you wanted to see it before it got to the ground,
right.
You know? And when you pull up and a C-123 and it starts to stall, they get what's called a stick shaker. And the wheel that the pilot's holding for flying,
mm-hmm.
would start shaking violently, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's built into the airplane, which tells you warning, you're reaching a stall speed or out or the way that the airplane is shaped, the way it is pointing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were heading up, kind of, and you were losing airspeed quickly, it would start what's called a stick shaker. And tell you that you're about to stall. And we would do that at the end of each run, which was frustrating to me. I didn't enjoy it. But the pilots were used to it.
Mm-hmm.
They ended up being the best pilots in the Air Force because of what they learned during those spray runs.
How would they deal with when the sticks started shaking? So
they would just turn and kind of level out a little. They didn't let them bother them. And they would do it at the end of every run.
Hmm.
It didn't bother them.
That had to be quite nerve-rattling.
Yeah, it was. But to someone who's not a pilot, yeah,
mm-hmm.
it's like your wife sitting beside you. She doesn't know what you're doing, and she's going to yap at you for every turn you make. I'm sorry, are you married?
No, sir. Okay. So tell me how many runs you would actually make. You had 1,000 gallons.
I had 1,000 gallons, and it depended on how long the target was or how wide it was. If it were just along a canal, we would just run it until our tanks ran out. I'm guessing 7 or 8 minutes. If it were a wide swath, we'd have to go back and forth and back and forth. Mm-hmm. So the actual spray runs probably with the tanks turned on probably didn't last for about 10 minutes at the most.
How effective was the spraying? Did you have to go back and hit spots again? Or?
Yeah, we found out sometimes that the jungle was so thick that all it would do was kill the top layer of trees, mm-hmm. and then you've got a bottom layer of brush and stuff, you know. So they send us back over it, but usually we didn't have to do that. Mm-hmm. As far as it being effective, when they first examined it, they found that it wasn't effective at all, and they had to increase the amount of spray that was coming out and some other stuff to make it even work. Mm-hmm. But it was working more and more, they sent a lot of airplanes over there after I quit doing it.
How much were you exposed to the actual defoliant itself?
Got it on me completely, practically every day.
Really?
We didn't have air conditioning. We had to fly with the doors open and with the windows open. If we were making a run and turn around and make a run right beside it, mm-hmm. we would get the spray just coming in the window there. I wore sunglasses in case to keep it out of my eyes. Mm-hmm. If you were down near that tank, there would be liquid around it from when they loaded it or something all the time, and no one paid any attention to it. Because, after all it was a defoliant that they'd used in the States for years and still use for years. Mm-hmm. It was no big thing. Plus, you know, what they had, 1 gallon per acre, mm-hmm. how much of that's going to hurt you?
Mm-hmm. What did the government tell you about the toxicity of it?
Zero. Not okay. Toxic.
Okay.
There were people down, I had heard people down there who tasted it. The shot club they had, and mm-hmm. people said that they drank it.
Mm-hmm. You didn't ever do that?
No, oh, no.
Okay.
It wasn't anything against it. I just didn't hear of that club.
Right. So the government basically had no warning about?
No warning or anything.
Okay. Okay, and you said that's fine. I believe it, and no questions.
No, we didn't. It didn't even come up. It was, you know, yeah. It was like to me, what if you spray olive oil? Mm-hmm. If I got to ask somebody, will it poison me? You know.
Right.
No, it was nothing.
Okay. Did you ever encounter any civilians on your flights? When you were spraying.
Did I ever?
Did you ever encounter them? Did you ever fly over them when you were spraying? Or
every now and then, it seemed like there would be a hut or something down there that we paid no attention to. I don't know if anybody was living in them or not, but
right.
At least that would be weird. Usually, it was just straight jungle.
Right. Okay. Did you ever take ground fire?
Oh yeah. Well, the first 6 months I went over there,
yes, sir.
It was very seldom. But after that, it really picked up so bad that every time we'd land, we'd have to go around and look for holes.
Mm-hmm. Were there any close calls with that?
Well, I had a hole shot through my desk, and it just ripped my map all to pieces. I didn't like that. But what really scared me was one went through the bottom of the airplane and through our garbage can we had in the cargo compartment, mm-hmm. and it sounded like a bomb had gone off, you know, boom. But it was just the echo from in that garbage can. Mm-hmm. That scared me. But that didn't. As far as hitting me, it never did.
Did you ever have any armor plating underneath your seats?
Well, they ended up putting... of course, the engineer ended up, they put a metal box for him to sit in while we were spraying. Mm-hmm. And the pilots and co-pilots, they put metal plating around their seats. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have one for myself, and I sat on top of a flak jacket.
Oh, really?
I was given a flak jacket to wear, and I said, well, you know, the bullets don't come in sideways. They come in from the bottom, so I just sat on it.
Did you ever get wounded, or was anybody on your crew ever wounded?
No.
Okay.
Not in that. Later on, when I guess another episode when we talk about spray dropping leaflets and using loudspeakers.
Okay.
My roommate got shot up.
Okay, okay. So the defoliant, in your estimation, was relatively effective after they made some initial adjustments?
Yes.
Okay, okay. And what did you think of the Vietnamese countryside as you were flying over it?
I thought it was beautiful down there in the Delta. Of course, you had so many rice crops, and the rest of it was other than some villages on the different rivers, especially the Mekong and the Saigon, not very populated at all,
mm-hmm.
mostly just straight jungle.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a beautiful area. And then when you fly to the north of Saigon into the mountains, they were gorgeous. The most gorgeous part was where the mountains and the ocean met, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
that's
sir.
Always pretty anyway. Mm-hmm. But I thought the whole country was beautiful.
Mm-hmm. You were over there for quite some time, kept going back. Did it become less beautiful after with all the spraying and defoliation that had gone on?
No, I didn't consider that. As a general rule, we didn't usually visit those areas again, you know? There wasn't
right.
any need to. But as far as the beautifulness of it, I probably got used to it and quit looking at it
mm-hmm.
later on.
Right.
Because after that, you couldn't even fly without getting shot at, you know.
Mm-hmm. What kind of weapons did you carry in the planes?
Well, we had no weapons. We had issued to us these carbines or
mm-hmm.
that... I never had shot, but these are rifles.
The M14?
And, for the enlisted people. And the officers had 45 pistols
mm-hmm.
that we could carry. And, you know, they were big and clumsy. But when we started doing those cargo missions, we would take supplies up to the special forces at Montagnard villages and everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Where these special forces had collected all kind of neat weapons,
mm-hmm.
Swedish K, Thompson submachine guns, and P-38 revolvers and all like that, and we would trade canned hams and stuff and they'd give us guns, and we kept a locker full of guns down there in our squadron,
mm-hmm.
and before a mission we'd go in there and get one. I wore a shoulder holster with a P-38 under it. And carried over my shoulder a Thompson submachine gun.
Wow.
And that was just for show. I didn't know how to shoot, and I never shot in either one of them.
Uh-huh.
Never did shoot them.
Yeah. Did you carry your .45 with you in addition?
No, after I got the P-38 Luger, I didn't use the .45 anymore.
And you never shot either one of them?
Well, we went to... train in those when we were back at Pope, you know, we had every year you had to shoot all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We'd shoot the 45s and we shot the M16s then, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was in Vietnam, I never shot any of them.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about when you left. Did you go 6 months over there? You were there till March 63?
Yeah, the second tour I was over there until January 63. And
did you make any other stops like you did the first time?
No, then we came straight on back. And then after the second tour, that was January of 63?
Yes, sir.
1 month later, less than a month, in February of 63, I went back over there as a volunteer, but not with wrench hand, but with mule train, which was the straight cargo people.
Mm-hmm. And what, were you still flying the 123? Or did
you 123,
okay.
Yes. That's all they had at Pope at that time.
Okay.
So I was in mule train from February 63 to July 63.
Tell me about that. What did you
do? Well, let's see. We would carry cargo around. Sometimes we'd make very few airdrops of some Vietnamese. And sometimes we would drop, we'd go over a village and drop out a pig or a couple chickens straight out, you know.
With parachutes?
No, just low level and let them hit and smash because they were going to eat them anyway.
Okay.
And that was kind of interesting. Other than that, it was just carrying cargo here, cargo there, cargo here.
Right. So you were a navigator on these flights.
Yes.
Okay, and what, how many crew were on board the 123?
They had the pilot, the co-pilot, and the engineer. Then they had a loadmaster also, and then the navigator.
Okay.
And there was a one interesting flight that I had while I was in the in that mule train outfit.
Okay.
That's we took off, and we had a mission to go to Cambodia, to Phnom Penh.
Were you based out of Saigon?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry, go ahead.
To go to Cambodia, to Phnom Penh,
yes,
and drop cargo off and pick up cargo and come back to Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And then the navigator would get off. The navigators, they didn't have a navigator for each airplane, and they were more valuable. So the navigator would get off there, and the pilots would go over to Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And fly about a week over there, which was easy missions because they had the radar and their radios that they could go to easy, and they didn't need a navigator.
Mm-hmm.
So we were flying those, and there was one interesting mission that I went on. We went over to, let's see, my pilot was, hold on, let me see here. I got this written. Okay. My pilot was named Lieutenant Hattelstad.
Mm-hmm.
And we went over to Cambodia and picked up a person who had worked at the embassy.
Yes.
They were kicking him out of the country because I don't know why. But we were to carry him back to Saigon where he'd get a flight back to the States. So he got on board, and that was all we were bringing back to Saigon. And being in the cargo compartment when we took off, I briefed the pilot, I briefed the guy who got on board from the embassy that how to use the parachute and that he could fit it up now. He didn't have to wear it, which we did for everybody who got on board.
Mm-hmm.
So he fitted it up, and I said, do you mind if I keep it on? I said, no, that's fine, but it's not going to be comfortable. So we took off, and he said, Do you have a latrine? And I said, yes, it's back there behind the door. Behind the door, the doors were open and strapped, had straps across them.
Mm-hmm.
Was a latrine for just men, you know, to use.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just a hole.
Right.
And he went back there, and he stayed, and he stayed in it. And I didn't see him come back, so I walked back there to see what he was doing, and he wasn't there. He jumped out.
Wow.
And I looked down, and his parachute was descending to the ground, and I ran up and told the pilot, hey, turn back, you know, this guy's jumped out. He didn't believe me, thought I was joking.
Right.
But when he saw him, we circled him until he landed. The guy landed and waved at us and walked off toward a road. So we called it on back to Saigon that it happened, and they sent some helicopters over and later got him. I think they brought him out of the country a second time in cuffs. But,
right.
But anyway, that flight, they dropped me off in Saigon. That was Hattelstad.
Mm-hmm.
And they went back over to Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 days later, he crashed and burned.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, and at an NKP. And his crew, whole crew was killed over there.
It's the third time this has happened.
Yeah.
For you. How did you feel this third time?
Well, since I wasn't even supposed to be on this one while they were over there, I didn't mind that.
Right.
And the pilot then was someone I didn't know very well, and you know, it wasn't that much. But it's interesting that just this past year, someone in Washington called me and said that they discovered that everybody on that crew except the flight engineer is on the Vietnam Wall.
Mm-hmm.
And asked me if I knew anything about whether the flight engineer was on that flight or not. And I told them absolutely yes, 100%. They wouldn't take off without him.
Right.
And they investigated and found out that he had, after they crashed, he'd lived for 3 days before he died. But when he died, he was in the hospital at the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't even sure, since he came from Thailand, that he was ever in Vietnam, and he wasn't added to the wall. So we got his name put on. They're putting it on in May of this year.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah,
that's great. Did you know this guy at all?
Yeah, I knew him, and he was a very good engineer, but we weren't close.
What happened to the plane?
It was over there at NKP. They had a big bamboo pole, and they had a pair of panties on top of it.
This is on the runway, or
no? It's over beside the runway. After you took off, you could turn right, and the people who would fly over there would turn and fly over it and blast it with their with the air coming out of the back, trying to knock the panties off of the panty pole.
Okay.
And it was a pretty well known thing to those people.
Uh-huh.
Well, he had decided he was going to get those panties off the panty pole, and so he had. He'd open up this back cargo ramp and rigged a chain around the a loop, and then flew real low level and
mm-hmm.
real slow, and banged the pole with the chain. I think he missed the first time, went around and made the second trip, and he stalled out or something happened, engine shut down or something. He crashed into a couple houses.
Mm.
That's. Not well broadcast, of course.
Right, right.
But that's what happened.
Okay. No, and did he get in any? I mean, he's dead. But how did the Air Force deal with that?
They sent someone over, investigated, and just said that he crashed. You know, the official airport report, which the guy who was investigated in Washington sent me.
Mm-hmm.
Mentions that, although they say it wasn't panties. They called it a red flag or something on the top of a bamboo pole.
Okay.
But they did give the particulars.
Right, okay.
So it's not something that's secret.
Right, right. I'm interested, you said there was a latrine there in the back of the plane.
Well, it was just a urinal is what it was.
Was it a hole that led out to the open
air? Yeah, let out. It was a hole that led out underneath the airplane.
Okay, okay. How long would your missions last, actually, from takeoff to landing, usually? I know it depended on how far you had to fly, but on average.
The cargo runs over there were an all-day affair. You'd take off one base and land at another base. They had them planned so it would take you most of the day, counting the ground time at each base.
Mm-hmm.
From one base to the other was probably, I'm guessing, a half hour or so. It wasn't far at all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then you'd have to stay on the ground while they were offloading and then unloading the other stuff. Then you'd go to another base.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a mini bases and all day long.
Okay.
For every 25 of those missions that you flew, take off to landing,
mm-hmm.
if you flew 25, you'd get an air medal.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I got 19.
Okay. From mule train.
Well, yes. When we were spraying, they didn't count it. They wouldn't get any medals at all. It was still thought to be assisting those people
mm-hmm.
and not doing anything on our own.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really a shame, you know. We did all that stuff, and we didn't get anything for it.
Mm-hmm. It is. Have yourself or anybody tried to rectify that situation?
I don't think so, but mainly because after my early wrench hand missions, they did start giving them air medals and different medals. So it was only those first two that I was on that didn't get anything.
The Farmgate missions.
Yeah.
Okay. What were some of the more interesting things you carried during Operation Mule Train?
From Mule Train, we usually carried the most things we carried was the food around to all of the different bases for the Army,
mm-hmm.
you know, pallets of it.
Mm-hmm.
We'd also carry the ammunition, and every now and then we'd carry a dead body bag, you know.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about that?
Those body bags?
Yes, sir.
It was a sad thing, you know, to see a body bag. Of course, it was all zipped up, and you didn't know who's in it, but you knew that there was a dead person there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, something you didn't want to even think about.
Mm-hmm. How did you deal with your experiences with death in that war?
With my experiences with what?
With death and just the body bags. And
it didn't. You know, young people have no idea that they could possibly die.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't even consider it. Oh, that happened to them, but it couldn't happen to me type atmosphere.
Right.
It didn't bother us at all.
Okay. Okay. Okay, sir, I want to ask you a couple other questions about Mule Train. Tell me about dropping pigs and chickens, live pigs and chickens, without parachutes out of the plane.
Why waste a parachute on something that you're going to just kill?
Right.
But we didn't do that often, but I do remember doing it a time or two. Especially sometimes we'd drop the chickens in, baskets, that would just break apart when it hit the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the chickens would get out while you're in the airplane. We'd have to chase them around the back, and they'd run out the back.
Oh, really?
They'd fly for a while and then go on down. But it was also funny. And the pigs, to keep them from running around the airplane, they were in wicker baskets.
Mm-hmm.
And we would just throw the whole basket out if we were low level.
Right.
There are a couple times I think we had little parachutes put on them. I think it was just to slow them down so it wouldn't spatter when they hit the ground.
Right.
But they would all be killed.
Would you?
And it was just to give food to the people down there.
Of course.
I don't know if it was for the Vietnamese army or for the people who lived in the hamlets, but we did that.
Would you actually see the animals hit the ground?
I did a couple times, but after that, it wasn't interesting anymore.
Right. Okay. And tell me, during this time you're there, February 63 to July 63 for Mule Train,
mm-hmm.
things in Saigon are really taking a turn for the worse as far as political upheaval.
Yeah.
What things did you see happening?
Well, during that time, they put a bomb in front of this Hung Dao Hotel in Saigon. It was where some the American servicemen stayed, and three Americans were killed then.
Mm-hmm.
And during this TDY also, this Buddhist monk, his name was Quang Duc, I think,
mm-hmm.
Was fed up with the way the Catholics of Diem's regime were treating the Buddhists, and self-immolated himself, which is set himself on fire in downtown Saigon, right in front of, the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And that went into every newspaper, I think, around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that is the start of people turning more against Diem.
Mm-hmm.
I think the reason the Buddhists were so mad at him was that they'd had a demonstration in Hue, because they weren't allowed to fly their flags at all above their buildings or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And while they were having a demonstration, Diem's police just shot and killed a bunch of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it just wasn't fair to them. And Diem was only getting people around him who were Catholic. I think he also had, not only was it that he was Catholic and they were Buddhists, but it was also the Buddhists and the Communists seemed to go together more than the Buddhists and the Catholics, and he was afraid of having close friends who were Buddhists because he thought they'd turn against him,
mm-hmm.
is my opinion of it.
Okay.
But anyway, that monk burned himself up, and things became more hectic downtown. You could tell the population were nervous.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel? Were you more nervous? Were you more careful?
I thought it was interesting, and I couldn't completely understand the whole thing of why they were hating him and Ngo Dinh Nu and Madame Nu so much. In fact, there was a restaurant on the Saigon Harbor called Mekong,
mm-hmm.
that was completely blown up. Well, not the restaurant blown up, but a bunch of Americans and Vietnamese were killed when they set off two bombs there. But I was eating there one day. A friend and I and a bunch of military people came on and went all the way around looking over the sides of the ship and stayed there with guns.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering what in the world was going on. And Madame Nu came in and sat down at a table about three seats above me with a bunch of people,
huh.
and ate. And she was a very nervous person who didn't trust even walking around unless it was kind of like Bush does now when he's visiting someone, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You got to have that guard around you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, boy, to have all that guard, she must really not be liked.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell the people who were sitting around there didn't much care to even look at her.
What was your impression of her? I thought she, at her.
I didn't like her at all. She was a good looking woman and real strict, and I think she had a lot, I'm not sure, and my guess is she had a lot to do with running Zim's government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I know her husband Nodin Nu did.
Mm-hmm. Well, she certainly had a hand in a lot of
what
did happen.
Yeah. And I think way later when Zim got killed, I think she was touring in America. I know she wasn't in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, anything else during Operation Mule Train that you feel like we need to cover?
No, that Mule Train one was pretty good, and I left there in July of '63.
Mm-hmm. And you went back to Pope again?
Yeah, I went back to Pope, and when I got there, I was called into the commander's office, and he said that, you've been going, that was my third trip over there.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you've been going over here to Vietnam, and we really need you back to train people who are going over to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know more than anybody else. You've got the experience. And so we're not letting you go back to Vietnam anymore. You're going to stay here and train people.
What rank were you at this time?
I was still a lieutenant. Yeah, I was still a lieutenant.
Okay.
And that was in July. So I went up to Langley and did a couple weeks of sea survival training, and then started training the people there at Pope who were going to go over to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in July. And that November, well, 3 or 4 months later, I got a call from Langley saying, hey, you ready to go back to Vietnam with a ranch hand?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I can't because they're not going to let me go. And they said, well, do you want to go? I said, yeah, that's exciting. This thing is boring.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, okay. And so a couple of days later, the commander called me into the office and said, hey, you've really got some good friends. I said, what are you talking about? He said, I got this message from Air Force headquarters. He said, put you on orders to go to Ranch Hand, Vietnam, and you're leaving in a week from now.
Hmm.
And he said, I don't know who you got that led you to do this, but you got some good friends. You ought to keep them. I don't know how they got me to do that, but I was back over there again.
This was November 63?
This was November 63.
Okay. Of course, a very, very pivotal month in the war and here at home. Zim is killed in early 63.
Yeah. He was killed as a matter of fact, he was killed in November the 2nd, 63. It was 2 weeks before I left to go back over there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was here when that happened. In fact, I was here when Kennedy got assassinated. That was 3 weeks then, wasn't it?
Yes, sir.
And then I went over there right after that, and the people over there explained the whole Zim thing, death to me, and I got the whole story on that, and it was pretty interesting.
What did they tell you?
Well, when they overthrew the palace, they went inside, and they were going to get to Zim, and Nodin Nu, and they weren't there. They were completely gone, which was a surprise to them. But it come to find out that they had a tunnel that went from the palace over to that French country club I went to.
Hmm.
And over there, I noticed back in the woods there was a fenced-in area when I'd go over there to play bridge and ping pong. And they had a tunnel from the palace that came out over on the grounds of that French country club that Zim and Nodin Nu had escaped through. So they had gone on over to Chelan and spent the night with a friend and then went to the Catholic Church the next day. And while they were at Catholic Church, they called. Big Men was running the army that was defeating him there. And they called Big Men and said, hey, if you'll let us go out of the country and give us safe passage, we'll turn ourselves in. And then Big Men said, fine, where are you? We'll do that. And they said, well, we're at the Catholic Church in Chelan. They sent a APC, a military vehicle over there, and picked them up in handcuffs.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way back, just shot both of them in the head, which was kind of startling. They should have just let them go. But I understand that they were afraid that that they would still cause problems, and they didn't want any more problems.
Right.
So they were killed in handcuffs in the back of that truck on the way back from where they thought they were going to be sent out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then the General Min, who was called Big Min, he was real tall for a Vietnamese. I took over, I think, for a little while, and then they had other people took over after him.
Tell me, before we talk a little bit more about that, when you got back into Saigon, tell me briefly about Kennedy's death, and you heard that you were at Pope.
I was at Pope. Kennedy died. It was a shocking thing. I was at the officers' club. It was I was up there, and so I left the officers' club, and rather than go to the squadron, I went on home and just watched the rest of it on TV for Walter Cronkite talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was a shock to me, and something you remember. You always remember where you were when that happened.
Right.
I was up there playing a pinball machine.
Mm-hmm.
At the officers' club.
Right. Did you call your parents?
I don't remember. I'm sure I did.
Mm-hmm. How much were you able to go see them when you would come back into North Carolina?
Well, it was probably at least every other weekend I'd drive up, and I still had some friends up there we'd pal around with, and mm-hmm. I played golf with.
Okay. Were you still playing ping pong when you came back to North Carolina?
Yeah. yeah, I was. But it was slowing down a lot.
Okay, okay. Now, when you went back to Saigon, to ranch in, were you based out of Saigon, or did you go...
Yeah, I was based out of Saigon.
Okay. Tell me what the mood of the city was like when you arrived in late November.
In late November? That was right after Zim was killed.
Right.
There was... The people seemed like they were excited, but they didn't know what the future held, and so they were... not certain of whether to be happy or sad.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the communist influence, there was no other communist influence. It was just, who's going to run the country type stuff.
Right. Okay. Where did you stay? Did you go back to this
apartment?
Let's
see. I stayed at that same apartment building that time, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you remember how much you paid for that?
No idea. You know, it's funny. When things are so cheap, you don't worry about it.
Right, right. So tell me about Ranch End. Was it pretty much the same as Farmgate, or were your missions expanded, or were they longer, more numerous?
No. Actually, the Farmgate, was just started with that Jungle Jim thing. And they changed our name to Ranch End mm-hmm. while we were in the Philippines before we ever got to Vietnam. So,
yeah.
So essentially, we were all Ranch End. Then the Ranch Hand were a special outfit. I really enjoyed it. We wore green berets like the Special Forces, Army Special Forces do,
mm-hmm.
but they were Vietnamese green berets like the Vietnamese troops wore,
mm-hmm.
and they folded down on the opposite side of them from the Special Forces. And then on the front of them, we wore a Vietnamese rank and with a patch on the side, the Ranch Hand patch, which, by the way, Al Kidd and myself designed the Ranch Hand patch.
Did you really?
The hats were really nice. We enjoyed wearing those. Later on, Nguyen Cao Ky, who was the head of the Vietnamese Air Force and wore a beautiful purple scarf, allowed us to wear purple scarves. And,
mm-hmm.
and the Special Forces and other military were really upset with what we wore, but we had special permission to wear them.
Mm-hmm.
So we enjoyed that.
So tell me about these missions when you went back in November 63.
Okay, we were getting shot all the time. I just hated to go on them because they had learned to shoot us. Before, they would sometimes shoot at us, but I was always in the lead airplane, and they wouldn't lead the airplanes. You know, you've got to lead them in order to hit them.
Mm-hmm.
And when they'd shoot at us, they usually hit the second airplane,
mm-hmm.
which it was fine with me. I was in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
But they learned how to lead them, and we were getting shot up pretty bad every time. So they decided to try some spraying at night to see if that wouldn't help.
Mm-hmm.
And flying 150 feet above the trees at night is kind of a thing you don't want to do very often.
Mm-hmm.
They had one of our C-123s would go out ahead of us and higher and drop these big flares so we could see the jungle and see where we were going. And we tried it, and we found out that the flares just silhouetted us, and so it was easier for them to see us, to shoot us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we tried it the next night without the flares to see if we could go on a moon with the moon, just the moon.
Yes, sir.
And it didn't work either. Plus, we were thinking that if we had an emergency, there was nowhere we could go. We couldn't see. So after those two flights, they gave up on trying to spray it at night. And we did all of our spraying first light. As soon as you could see good enough that I could map read to get onto the target, mm-hmm. we would go.
Okay. So you get up early morning, you do your spray mission.
And I'd leave my house sometimes at 4 in the morning. Mm-hmm. In fact, in order to get there, I would have my maid tell her I wanted a taxi at my house at 4 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And usually the taxi would come up in front of my apartment there, and he would stay in there and sleep in it. So he'd be there in the morning, and I could take a taxi to the base.
Mm-hmm.
And
how far away from the base did you live?
Oh, probably a 10 or 15-minute drive.
Okay. And were you spraying more in the delta, or did you start expanding northward?
No, they really went north after I left, after this one. But while I was there, it was mainly delta.
Okay.
With the exception of one Quinon flight, I think it was all Delta. And you know that Renshan sprayed to kill crops, the rice crops. Mm-hmm. That, luckily for me, I guess, that only started, and that's where they really got into a bunch of firefights, that only started right after I left the last time from Renshan.
Okay.
So I wasn't into that.
Okay. So describe your mission. Were you still using the same formation?
Yeah, it was a formation of two, sometimes three, airplanes and flying at 150 feet with no wind. We usually were lower than that. Sometimes I've seen us pull up because of tall trees.
Mm-hmm.
So I know, you know, you're right up above the ground. Mm-hmm. And we're flying at about 130 knots.
Okay.
And spraying and then turning around and coming back across it, unless it was a place that got shut up pretty good, and we'd go back the next day or some other time to try to spray it the second time.
Mm-hmm. I've heard rumors that, or other Ranchan folks who were involved in that, say that there was a really poor intelligence as far as where some of the hot zones were that you didn't want to go, and also that a lot of times people knew where you guys would be spraying in the next day or so. Did you find that to be true?
Yes. As far as intelligence on the enemy, we had absolutely, from the briefings and everything, no idea where they were,
mm-hmm.
really. As far as them knowing that we were coming, it got to the point where we thought that they were ganged up there because they knew we were going to be there that day, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, how in the world could they all be shooting at us at once, you know,
mm-hmm.
every time? So it got to the point where we didn't know what to do, and so they started keeping the spray flight mission secret so that nobody would know it until we accept our commander,
mm-hmm.
and everyone who sent it down, until we took off. And when we took off, we'd always fly straight east until we got into the ocean,
mm-hmm.
go all the way around to the bottom and come in from the bottom so that they wouldn't have any idea where we were going or where we were coming from.
Wow.
And, you know, we would do all this, so we still get shot up.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
How do you think they knew that? Just speculating. Was it a leak somewhere, or?
I think there was a leak. I think there was a leak somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It could have easily been such as someone watched me because I had to be on the flight,
mm-hmm.
and anytime I'd take a taxi 4 in the morning to the base, they figure, oh, hey, he's going to spray.
Right.
You know. Yes. You know, that's an easy thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just radio some other people, hey, they're spraying today.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they didn't have any idea, I'm thinking, of where we were going to spray unless they had some higher-up Vietnamese who told them.
Mm-hmm.
But we quit telling the Vietnamese, and we still got shot up.
How many spray missions would go out a day?
One.
Okay, so it was just your mission, just your flight?
Yes.
Okay.
And I was the lead, and if I were sick, it was no mission.
Okay. How often did that happen?
Didn't.
Okay. Tell me about your briefings. What were they like?
As far as the briefings down at the Army 2nd Advan or something, completely useless, a waste of time. I know nothing from them, learn nothing from them.
Hmm. would they try to tell you?
I think they would try to tell us where the enemy was, but they had no idea. And it made no difference, so what?
Mm-hmm.
And it was prior to the time that they had 50 calibers, really, that would tear into an airplane so bad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Ours were just small holes.
Okay. Tell me about any outstanding incidents that stand out in your mind from this tour.
From this one, none other than when my pilot Hattelstadt crashed over there in the Thailand. Okay. There's nothing interesting happened on this one.
Okay. How long were you there during this tour?
I was there until, this was the mule train tour. I was there until, this was the fourth tour. I was there until April of 64.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, that other one was a mule train tour. And that April of 64 is when I came back. And that October is when they did the first crop destruction mission. I wasn't in on those.
Okay. Were you still flying 123s?
When I came back from this fourth tour,
mm-hmm.
they had 130s at Pope, C-130s.
Okay.
The 123s were gone. And they had a quandary. They didn't know what to do with me because I had never been in a C-130. So they put me into the wing there and had me fly only C-47s with base flight. And my job was running the Air Force people who came in and flew to the dark zones who weren't people. I was in the combat air delivery branch there.
At Pope.
Okay.
How long did you stay in this position?
Well, that was in, I was assigned there in, I came back in April,
mm-hmm.
and was in the C-47s,
mm-hmm.
and they sent me in about a year later. They sent me to PCS to Nha Trang, Vietnam, in the C-47s.
Okay.
I volunteered.
Okay. Now, did you start training up in the 130s?
No. By then, I'd never been in a 130.
Hmm.
And since I was in base flight only to get my flying time,
mm-hmm.
and that base flight had one C-47 at Pope,
mm-hmm.
I flew in that.
Okay.
And I would just fly every month to get my flying pay. Other than that, I had no idea. And I had never been in a C-130.
How different was the 47 from the 123?
The 47 from the 123, they didn't even have a place that the navigator could look out the window.
Wow.
It was, and all we had, they had a navigator seat there, but all he had was a compass and an oxygen thing that would blink every time you'd put on your oxygen mask.
Mm-hmm.
And you could sit there and look at those two gadgets if you wanted to, or you'd stand up there behind the pilot and co-pilot and map read. It's what we all did. It was not made for navigators.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah.
So you were there for about a year in North Carolina at Pope before you went back.
Yeah, from 7 April 64, and I started training to go back in 23rd of August 65.
Okay. And what were you training for exactly?
It was I trained at the 1st Air Commando Wing in Forbes, Kansas, and we trained with these C-47s, we called them Goonie Birds. We trained with these Goonie Birds,
mm-hmm.
that were going to fire Gatling guns over there called Spooky or Puff the Magic Dragon or something like that.
Yes,
I don't know if you've interviewed any of those people, but...
yeah, I've heard of Puff many times.
Yeah, and I trained with them, and it was really something interesting. You know, the pilot would just turn that thing over and shoot that Gatling gun, and it would just look like a hose of red because of the tracers that were coming out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting. I know that they said that if you were on the ground and they shot you with one of those,
mm-hmm.
before you could hit the ground dead, you'd have 100 more bullets in you,
mm.
which means there's a lot of bullets coming down there.
Yes, sir.
And while we were training in Kansas up there in the fields, they said, here, I'll show you how much this is coming out. And the pilot leaned over and shot into a pond.
Mm-hmm.
And the water boiled up, just went, flew up in the air, all of the water. So it was something.
Wow.
So I was impressed with that. But so they sent me over to PCS and I got there in November of 65
okay.
to Nha Trang, Vietnam. But rather than keep me in the C-47 that had the Gatling guns, mm-hmm. they sent all the navigators, I think except one, up to Nha Trang for leaflets and loudspeakers, and that's what we did.
Okay. First of all, tell me about the base at Nha Trang and the differences of being there and what your housing was like and your food and the general things like that.
Okay, Nha Trang has some beautiful places. It's right up there on the beach, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We rented a French villa one block from the beach. It was six of us, navigators, all navigators. We rented a villa. I don't know, again, what we paid for it. And it was a big fenced-in area and a luxury place, really.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you each have your own bedroom?
Well, there was two of us to a bedroom, three bedrooms, two of us to each bedroom.
Okay.
And we went down and bought some cheap beds with mosquito netting around them and put it in there. We didn't have air conditioning or any of that stuff.
Okay. Did you have some of the local Vietnamese come in and cook and clean for you?
Well, we didn't have a Vietnamese cook at this one. We had someone who'd come by and clean up. The owners of the place lived in servant quarters behind us, but we didn't get them to come in and clean up. So as a general rule, we didn't have anyone to clean up. We didn't care.
Okay. And for recreation, would you guys go to the beach?
Yeah, we'd go swimming a lot. While I was there, another navigator and myself went over to Thailand and bought a couple Honda motorcycles,
mm-hmm.
and that was a lot of fun riding around there with the Honda motorcycles. We did that a lot.
Okay. So did you feel relatively safe in Nha Trang?
Yeah.
Okay. What was the city like to you?
The city of Nha Trang was a lot, way, way, way smaller than Saigon, but they had, several nice restaurants and several nice bars, and we hit those every day.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how much beer I drank down there. But the Vietnamese beer called 33 Bami Ba was what everybody did, so we did it.
Mm-hmm. Now, would the drinking affect your flights the next day?
No,
you had to get up so early?
No, I don't think it ever did. I guess you never know, but no, I would never wake up so drunk that I'd have hangovers or anything.
Okay. What about the alcohol use? Was it becoming more and more prevalent, or was it about the same since you
I think it was the same. Everybody in Vietnam, that was the way they killed the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't the whiskey, it was the beer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, today I drink maybe a couple beers a year. But over there, it was three or four beers a day.
Okay. What about drug use? Did you see any of that during your tours?
Well, while I was at Ranch Hand and Mule Train,
mm-hmm.
there was never, ever a mention or ever did I see any drug use or hear about it.
Okay.
I think while I was with the C-47s, I had heard that a lot of the Army people were getting high on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to tell you this story. It's a true story.
Okay.
I was a young captain there. I had never, ever even smoked marijuana in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I went outside of my house there and to the Ciclo driver. I heard that they always, you could get drugs from them.
Mm-hmm.
And bought two marijuana cigarettes, I think, because 50 cents each.
Mm-hmm.
And I smoked one that night after I drank some beer, and I went to sleep, and it didn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I smoked the other one the second night, and I noticed that it made me feel like I'd been drinking the beers, except my stomach was still empty. A much better feeling.
Right.
And in my life, I've never had another one, but if they were legal, I'd probably go back to it.
Okay.
But I did have those two, and it was, there was the first Ciclo driver I'd come up to, so there must be some people over there who was familiar with that
mm-hmm,
stuff.
Mm-hmm. How about the other guys in your house? Were they
No,
they tried
none.
Okay.
In fact, they didn't even, they, I was smoking while one of them was sitting there talking to me that night while I was sitting on my bed. Mm-hmm. And they never ever mentioned anything.
Hmm.
They didn't even want to puff or anything.
Huh.
But we didn't talk about it.
They didn't know.
But you know, I was an officer. I don't know what the enlisted people did.
Right, right.
But so I've had two marijuana cigarettes.
Okay.
Other than that, it was just straight to beer.
Okay. So tell me the culture differences between Saigon and Da Trang and the civilian population. Things were very, you know, unstable in Saigon politically for a while there while you were there, and then you're in Da Trang. Was it very, very different? Could you tell amongst the civilian population a big difference?
As far as the people, the difference was, it seemed like they were more country rather than city,
mm-hmm.
Just like you would find Raleigh rather than New York or something.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no difference in their attitudes at all, and they were friendly, too.
Okay. You said you did drive your motorcycles around town,
yeah.
and you were able to, I guess, go shopping and
yeah.
do things like that.
Yeah.
Were they friendly?
Yes, everybody was friendly, and it wasn't a big place where you could do a lot of shopping.
Mm-hmm.
They only had, I bet you they didn't have 10 bars in the whole city.
Hmm.
And the restaurants, there were maybe three or four restaurants that you would go to. Other than that, you know, you cooked at your own place.
Okay.
And we didn't do a lot of cooking at our own place, but we ate awful lot of those sea rations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'd bring them home from the base, and that's what we eat.
Which ones did you like best?
I had my favorites then, but it's a long time ago, and I don't remember.
Okay. Now, this is November 1965, and getting into 1966. What did you know about what the United States was trying to do in Vietnam?
I did know that they were advancing so much with building places for the army and the different military units that it had gone 10 times as more people. It seemed like every year is 10 times more people than it was the year before.
Mm-hmm. Meaning Americans?
Yeah, Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think somewhere around that time they opened up Cameron Bay. And that was right beside Da Trang, and so, you know, we were close to that.
Right. What did you think about American policy in Vietnam at the time?
And right now I can tell you, but back then I had, I could care less. It didn't affect me at all.
Did you know why the United States was in Vietnam at that time?
Yeah, it was to help them keep the communists out, and it was that simple. The domino theory, that's all you hear every day.
Mm-hmm. Did you buy into the domino theory at that time?
I did at that time. I don't now.
Okay. So tell me about your spray missions there when you went back. Now, your tour here was going to be for a year. Is that correct?
No, this wasn't spray missions. This was...
excuse me. That's right.
This was the C-47s, and we dropped the leaflets, and we had loudspeakers.
Tell me about doing that.
Well, as far as the leaflets, one major... about that time, the B-52s
mm-hmm.
would fly out of Guam on a mission called Arclight
mm-hmm.
and just completely change a jungle into a bunch of holes
mm-hmm.
By dropping from way high altitude a bunch of bombs.
Right.
And we had the job of being right beside them while flying right close to that area while they were doing it. And as soon as they would finish, we'd go over the area and drop surrender leaflets and say, hey, you know, you can give yourself up and you won't get this stuff
mm-hmm.
to them. So we had those missions with the B-52s that we did really often.
Tell me about the destruction the B-52 could level.
Tell you about what?
Tell me about the B-52 destruction and watching that up close firsthand.
It was exciting seeing those holes appearing on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one particular mission on Arclight. We had we get the message down of when they were going to be on target and where were they going to be,
mm-hmm.
and we had to be there a little bit after that. We were dropping surrender leaflets, and I looked down at the ground, and the holes were exploding, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, my, what's going on? And I looked up, and the B-52s were dropping straight down to us.
Oh, wow.
And we were somewhat had messed up the times, and we were there at the same time they were. So that wasn't very exciting, but we didn't get hit with anything.
Right. Could you see the B-52 above you at 30,000
feet
or so?
Yeah, but they were way, way up high.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What did the leaflets say? Did you read them?
The leaflets were all different kinds.
Uh-huh.
They had the one that we're most famous for is the surrender leaflets, or Chu Hoy leaflets,
mm-hmm.
Which were interesting in that they all had serial numbers on them. And when we would drop those, we would mark down the serial numbers,
mm-hmm.
which was a group of them from such and such to such and such, and where we had dropped them. And the Viet Cong would usually find those and put them in their pocket in case they got captured. They could say, hey, I was turning myself in or something.
Right.
Or for some other interesting reason. Or when they got killed and they got searched, they'd have them.
Mm-hmm.
And we were using that when we'd find one of those people, we were using that to find out where they had picked it up
mm-hmm.
so that we could figure out where they were moving from, too.
Right.
And it really helped us out there, too.
Right. What other kind of leaflets besides the Chu Hoy and Surrender?
I once collected a bunch of them, and I gave them away, but I tried to collect one of each kind. We had leaflets that say, hey, turn in your gun, we'll give you $1,000. And some of them said that give yourself up, we'll give you, I don't know, $5,000. And I heard that there's some people down there that made a living by turning themselves in every now and then.
How effective do you think those leaflet drops were, in your opinion?
I think they were very effective. The writings up were that from when we started until during that time, it increased something like 35 times as many people turned themselves in
mm-hmm.
as they did before.
Right.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And then the other part of it, we had loudspeakers on there, too, that we did.
How would that work?
We would always have an escort because they would shoot at us all the time. In fact, the C-47s were the most shot at airplanes in the Vietnam War, with the exception of wrench hand.
Mm-hmm.
So I went from one shot at to another shot at.
Mm-hmm.
But we would carry an escort. Sometimes fighter planes with napalm, but a lot of times we carry those C-47s beside us who had the Gatling guns,
mm-hmm.
and we'd fly over an area, and first off, they'd capture some Viet Cong person and get him to tell the name of all of the people who's with him and where they're stationed and where they are right now, and then they would take and record all this message, and so we'd go up there, and we'd circle, and we'd say, and we'd have a Vietnamese guy get on the loudspeaker and say, okay, people, we know you're there. And then he'd name a few of them
mm-hmm.
and say, give yourself up. If you don't, we're going to kill you. And if you ever shoot at this airplane, you're going to regret it. And if they'd shoot at it, we'd back off, and then the Gatling gun would come in there and just wipe them off.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd go back over and say, see that? Don't do that. And tell them, call them by name and tell them to surrender and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that was pretty effective.
Was this flying over villages mainly, or did it?
No, this was over places where the Viet Cong were coming in from the Ho Chi Minh Trail as a general rule.
Okay.
It was over the troops, not the villages.
Okay.
And as a matter of fact, we had what's called a no-doze mission.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go up, I don't know, somewhere around 9 or 10 o'clock at night over where the troops, we knew where the Viet Cong were massed,
mm-hmm.
and fly over their area all night with screams and funeral music.
Really?
Just to keep them awake.
Screams.
Screaming, babies, people, and in the background, funeral music. And if they ever shot at us, we'd blast them again and then go back over it.
Uh-huh.
And we'd stay there all night for maybe, I don't know, how long you can fly, 8 hours,
uh-huh.
With that music.
Now, how loud was it to you guys inside the plane?
It was pretty loud. We had earplugs we had to use, and of course we had our headphones over top of the earplugs.
Uh-huh. But you could still hear it.
Oh yeah, but you know it was Vietnamese. I had no idea what they were saying.
But a scream is a scream is a scream, right?
Yeah, and so we did that. We did that at 3,000 feet,
okay. Okay.
Which kept a lot of the rifles from hitting us, but you know.
Right.
And we also had, back during that time, the Viet Cong also had those 50 calibers,
mm-hmm.
which were the first things really that could reach an airplane good, you know,
mm-hmm.
and tear into it. And we had this standing policy that if we got shot with a 50 caliber, we left the area. It wasn't that important.
Okay. So as soon as that would you would...
Yeah. You could look down at the ground and see them shooting at you with machine guns and tracers, and they would, when they're coming your way, they go look like they're going so slow, you know, with the tracers because they're coming straight at you.
Right.
But they would usually not reach you. But every now and then, there'd be a big white flare go boom and go right on by you real quick,
mm-hmm.
and you say, "Uh-oh, that's one of those," and you get out of that area.
Mm-hmm. How many were on the crew of the C-47?
C-47, pilot, co-pilot, and me and the engineer.
Okay. Did you mainly fly just one plane, or did you have a couple of planes
formation
with you?
I think up there at Natrang, I think we had four C-47s, but we'd fly one plane at a time. The rest of the squadron were U-10s, which did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Two seats, but a single pilot
mm-hmm.
Airplanes that did the same thing.
Okay. I'm curious, did the funeral music and screaming ever bother you guys that much?
No. Okay. We didn't pay attention to it.
Would you sleep all day and prepare those kind of missions?
Yeah. But we didn't do those, you know, kind of every night. We only did that occasionally.
Uh-huh. How about the briefings this time around? Were they any better than what you described before?
I'm going to tell you what's the truth. I have no idea. I don't even remember the briefings this time around. But in my whole career in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
I don't ever remember a briefing that was important to me. It was just some wasted time.
Hmm.
I just don't think we knew that much about where the enemy was,
uh-huh.
you know?
Uh-huh. Talk about the enemy a little bit. How can you describe him?
I don't know. I never saw one.
What about their tactics?
I think the big secret with the enemy being so winning out in the end was they got the people for them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think way back Mao Zedong said in one of his little red books there that, you know, if you're a fish, you got to have the water with you or you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're having a revolt, you got to have the people with you or you're not going to make it either.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that, and that's the truth, and they knew that over there, and those Viet Cong turned the countryside in their favor.
Okay.
That's the whole secret.
How could have the United States done it differently? How could the United States overcome that if that was the situation on the ground?
I don't think... There's always saying, yeah, well, if we'd have bombed them here and done it earlier and done all of this, I don't think... ever you could have turned their hearts and minds.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, we weren't Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
In 69, when Ho Chi Minh died,
yes.
I was downtown Saigon, and I was still in the middle of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed all the Vietnamese people around there were wearing these black labels, and I asked them, I said, what's that? And they said, this is in honor of Ho Chi Minh. I mean, I'm talking about the people in Saigon, everybody,
mm-hmm.
right in front of the military troops. They were worshiping Ho Chi Minh. No one wore anything when them died.
Mm-hmm.
They were always for Ho Chi Minh, I think, because he wanted a country, you know. Whether it was communist or not, he wanted a country, not run by the French, not run by the Americans, not run by the Japanese.
Right. How was the morale of the men around you?
It was pretty good. There wasn't that much that they could do, you know, sports-wise and everything else, but they got along real good together. And I think they made friendships that they still have reunions and love to get together.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to ever make one of the Mars calls to call home?
Yeah, I did that one time. Oh, no, I did that while I was in Thailand. But I didn't do that when I was in Vietnam. I did that in Thailand one time, just to see how it was like, and I called my mother and father, and they were surprised.
Yeah. How long did your conversation last?
Oh, know, 10 or 15 minutes. Yeah. But I remember that was a real nice thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
How about other contact with home? Were you writing letters now more
regularly? Yeah, I was. And I hate to get this public, but I was also telling them to send me some $100 bills in cash, because I could take that down and trade it in for piastres and really get a good bargain.
Uh-huh. Well, that makes sense. That makes, you know,
yeah.
If you're out there supplying yourself and buying things, then
yeah,
you would need that.
Yeah, you know, the black market was so much money was so much higher valued than the other stuff.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have any contact with troops from other countries, the Australians?
When I was down in Saigon, it's before I was within C-47s. Mm-hmm. The Australians, they had this thing. Well, they could outdrink us, outscream us, party us,
right,
sports, anything they wanted, you know. I noticed also that they had these nice hats that they wore, these kind of a, almost like a cowboy brim,
mm-hmm,
that they wore. And, in fact, we had asked to be able to wear a hat like that. And I think then over SyncPAC was Admiral Felt. He said, "Hey, we got these hats. You know those big old hats that they wore down during Panama when they were building a canal? I don't know what they were called,
mm-hmm,
but they're made out of plastic." He told us we could wear those because they were issued. And later on, they gave us some hats like those Australians wore, but we enjoyed those real good.
Yeah.
Australians, I'd land at their base sometime. They were usually at a different base than what we were, so they could be completely separate.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all real friendly, and we got together. They could outdrink us. So.
Was that true? They could outparty you guys?
Oh, yeah.
Outplay you and everything?
Yeah, in every way. I don't care what it was, they could do it better than we could.
Was there any resentment toward that? Or
No. It was just... let's have a party type stuff. No.
Okay. Did you ever have any experience with medevac or the dust-off units?
No.
Mm-hmm. Nothing at all?
No. As well, you know, I'd carry dead people and wounded out sometimes. But
right.
I once was sent up to... in fact, I got a medal for it. I was sent up to a base close to the train while I was in mule train,
mm-hmm,
to pick up an army man who had tried to kill himself by cutting his throat.
Mm-hmm.
He threatened suicide. They'd put him in this room by himself, and in the window of a room was a razor blade that he got a hold of,
mm-hmm,
and he just sliced himself all to pieces. And we were to bring him back down to a hospital in Saigon, and the base was, it was the middle of the night, and the base didn't have any lights,
mm-hmm,
and wanted to know if we'd volunteer to land there if they'd put a Jeep on the front and the back with their lights on to tell us where the runway was. and we did. It was a pretty dangerous mission. We went up there and brought him back, and I think they gave us a commendation medal for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember we brought him back in a stretcher, and he was conscious, and we were on the way back, and he asked me if I had a cigarette, and I gave him a cigarette, lit it up, and gave it to him.
Uh-huh.
He took a big puff of that cigarette, and the smoke came out of his throat.
Oh, really?
And you think, oh, and that's where he cut himself so bad, you know.
Oh, wow. I bet that was a bit freaky.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how long were you in the train?
In the train, I was there for a year. I was a PCS.
Okay.
And I was there until... departed the train in December of 66.
Okay.
But from there, my orders were to go to Tachikawa, Japan.
Mm-hmm.
All that was another Vietnam mission.
Really?
Yeah.
How so?
Well, the mission for the Tachikawa C-130s was to fly 15 days in Vietnam,
mm-hmm,
and come back and stay about a week, and then go 15 days to Vietnam and back about a week for the whole 3 years I was there.
Okay, so you're rotating out.
Yeah, in and out for 15-day trips. It was interesting because they sent me to Tachikawa thinking that since I came from Pope, I was a C-130 guy. But I'd never been in one in Tachikawa. I had C-130s.
Right.
So I hadn't been to a C-130 school, but I had them. They trained me. I just flew with someone until I learned how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know of anybody else who's ever who's ever flown C-130s most of their life and has never been to a C-130 school. But I hadn't even been to one.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to Tachikawa. That was in December of. Let's see, when was that? On December of 66.
Okay. How was it learning in the C-130? Was it more difficult?
C-130 is really nice. The Navigator C is nice. They got a nice radar. I hadn't even used radar before. And all of the instruments the Navigator needs.
Okay. And you were in 130s the rest of your time?
Yep. That's it.
Okay. Tell me about Japan. What was that like?
Tachikawa, that's where it is. I met a nice Japanese woman, and we got married. She's really? In the other room.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's wonderful.
So, you know, that was a nice place.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. How far, were you able to go, well, I guess you just answered the question, able to go off base and enjoy Japan culturally and socially and all that. How much different was it than to Vietnam, comparing the two?
Comparing the two, Vietnam is crude,
mm-hmm.
and Japan is probably better than America as far as being up to date.
Uh-huh.
And the people of Japan are so nice that they're weird. I mean, you have never run across, not just because I'm married to a Japanese, but those people, they have learned how to treat people.
Uh-huh.
And they're so nice. Even if they didn't like Americans because they were in the Second World War,
right.
They treat you like real nice.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, unless it was an old person, old man or something, they had no regrets from the Second World War.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever run into those people, the older folks who had experienced?
Yeah, and I try to change the subject and get them off of it. They want to talk about. Being in the war, in the Second World War, fighting against us, you know.
Right.
And it was not something that, it's like abortion, don't talk about it.
Uh-huh. Can you talk about how you met your wife?
I was at the officers club, and a good friend, bachelor friend of mine, was dating a Japanese girl at the officers club,
mm-hmm.
and the girl had her girlfriend with her,
mm-hmm.
and we sat there, and she didn't speak a word of English, and I didn't speak any Japanese, and so other than, hi, how you doing, and she smiled.
Mm-hmm.
That was my future wife.
Huh.
I'd found out that she had been taught that if she talks to Americans, the only word that English that she needs to know is no. And that was probably pretty good training, you know.
Right.
Kept me after her, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But I went and took some formal Japanese courses over there through the University of Maryland, and we dated for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and it got to where I just decided I couldn't even do any. While I was even flying in Vietnam, I would write her letters in Japanese, you know. I was getting that good at language, and
wow.
I got to where I just said, hey, this is it. I got to live with her or else I can't live.
Right.
And we married in July of 68, which after we dated 2 years.
Okay.
But for the wedding, I brought my mother over.
Did you really?
Yeah. And I had the wedding in downtown Tokyo at the embassy.
Mm-hmm.
We left a year later to the States.
Okay. Tell me about your trips over to Vietnam, these 15-day spans. Where would you stay, first of all?
Okay. When we would go to Vietnam for the 15-day trips, mm-hmm. we would stay at Cameron Bay.
Okay.
And fly missions out of there. It was just the same as the 123s, except a lot more of them and carrying a lot more cargo. And we'd have to land at a little longer airfield than the 123s would.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you flew in and out of Cameron.
Yeah, in and out of Cameron to everywhere.
Okay. And these were specifically spray missions, is that correct?
No. This is cargo.
It's totally cargo.
Totally cargo. After I left that ranch hand, before I got into C-47s, and I left the ranch hand, that was the last spray mission.
Okay. Now, how was this similar to mule train, or were you more
Yes, it was similar to mule train, just a larger airplane.
Okay. And tell me what you would haul around the country.
Supplies for all of the Army bases. Mm-hmm. Always carry food, carry the mail, and carry the equipment and the bullets and ammunition and stuff they needed.
Mm-hmm.
We sometimes carry jeeps and stuff. We wouldn't carry, we don't think we'd carry tanks. We couldn't get those in there. But, all the stuff that they would need in order to keep building up their bases.
Right. And did you get shot at a lot during the 30s?
Well, not as much as we did on the others because we were flying higher and landing at larger bases, and so they were well protected.
Okay.
So, you know, they still had the 130s that went into places like Kaysan for that.
Right.
I'm lucky that I wasn't one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you ever fly into any really hot zones?
Well, we still got shot at and still got holes in our airplane, but they slowed down a lot. There's nothing that I can remember that was really exciting about that stuff other than just hauling cargo.
You had mentioned earlier when I asked you about had you been wounded, you said no, but one of your pilots had been.
Yeah, that's while I was in the leaflets and loudspeakers. It wasn't my pilot. It was my roommate navigator.
Okay.
Jerry Duffy, he's dead now, but he didn't get killed over there. He was a navigator in my room, and he was flying the C-47s. I told you we didn't have a navigator seat, and we stood up behind the pilot and co-pilot.
Yes, sir.
Well, a bullet came through the cockpit and went through the co-pilot's armrest. And the co-pilot didn't have his arm on it at the time. And from the armrest went straight into the stomach of my roommate, Jerry Duffy.
Mm.
And he lost a spleen and a bunch of stuff and immediately got out of the Air Force and went back to New York, I think, where he opened a he was still got around where he opened a ski resort, I heard, but he's since died.
Okay.
But that's he got wounded. Other than all those other people who got killed, that was the only wound we had.
Any memorable experiences on the 130 during these 3 years you're in Japan flying over? Was it as routine as it sounds, or did it vary from time to time?
Well, I don't think I can remember anything exciting happened of those. They were pretty routine.
Okay. And you did this in Japan from December 66 until when?
Let's see. I was at Tachikawa, and I left there in December the 2nd, 1969. Two or three weeks, it was about 3 weeks after Ho Chi Minh had died.
When he did die, you said you saw the people in Saigon?
Who had the black patches on. Other than that, there was nothing.
Okay. How did the Americans react?
I don't even remember that they even cared.
Yeah. Now, in Japan, did you live on base, or were you able to get housing off base with your wife?
I lived on base. I lived at the BOQ until I got married, and then they moved me into a real nice on base house there.
Okay.
Yeah, I enjoyed that.
Okay.
And while I was over there, I made major.
Okay. Let me ask you a few questions about life at the base and just kind of in general looking back at your Vietnam career. Did you ever run into any race issues?
I ran into a race issue before I ever got, while I was in aviation cadets,
okay.
That I don't even know if it's worth mentioning, but it was in San Antonio.
Mm-hmm. What happened?
I was upper class and a lieutenant, kind of a boss of an underclass who had just come in,
mm-hmm.
And they had one black guy, and looking back, that's the only black guy back at that time. That's the only black guy I can remember seeing there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he was really, really intelligent and really nice. And we went downtown. I was upper class and he was underclass. Went downtown San Antonio to go to a movie one Saturday. And we went up to the movie, and I bought a ticket, and he was behind me, and he gave him the money, and they said, "I'm sorry, you can't come in here." And he said, "Why?" He said, "We don't allow colored people." Hmm. And so I went to her, I said, to the window, and I said, "Can I get my money back for my ticket?" She said, "Oh, certainly." And I said, "But I've got some friends inside. Can I go in for a minute?" And she said, "Certainly." So I went into the movie. It hadn't started yet.
Mm-hmm.
And went up to the balcony, and I yelled down an announcement that anybody from Aviation Cadets, this is off limits and to leave. And 15 or 20 people walked out and got their money back.
Mm-hmm.
And we put it off limits. I don't know whatever happened, but that was in 1960. In 1960, yeah.
Okay.
San Antonio.
Why did you feel so strongly about that?
Well, he was my friend, and I'm going to tell you, throughout my life, I'd never had anything about the race.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it didn't make any difference to me.
Was that the way you were raised?
Yeah, that was the way I was raised, and I really thank my father for it. Was just another person, you know.
Right.
I'm sure that he brought that into my mind.
Right.
And so it was something I didn't even think about. Well, you know, when I married my Japanese girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
North Carolina, only the year before that, didn't allow mixed marriages. You know, I couldn't have married her in North Carolina.
Wow.
So things change.
Yes, sir.
But as far as Vietnam, I didn't see any race stuff there.
Okay. How about any tension between those who were drafted and those who had enlisted and were officers?
The rule was, and it was really strictly enforced, you didn't get together.
Hmm.
You didn't party together. You didn't do anything together. You weren't allowed to.
Okay. Was that ever broken? Or?
Yeah, you know, some people fell in love and married enlisted girls.
Right.
Later, I don't know of any of it during that time, but the sergeants and officers would get together for, pig picking or a barbecue or something sometimes, but you'd, as a general rule, didn't pal around together.
Right.
You just didn't do it.
Okay.
And I didn't. I stayed only with the officers. The others were friendly and nice, but they stayed with their people and we stayed with ours.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was more of that than it was a race.
Right.
You just didn't do it. You know, they had their own clubs. They weren't allowed into an officer's club,
sure.
And we didn't go into the enlisted club.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the relationship you had with your men and your unit.
Well, the ones that you lived with in your house, they ended up being almost like brothers. The others were just real friendly. The pilots and et cetera were just real friendly people that you got along real good with. There was never... Even if you didn't care for them, you didn't show it.
Right. Okay. Do you remember particularly a more humorous event that comes to mind about your time in Vietnam?
Well, on this, there's many, many, many humorous things. I remember in Saigon, when I was living at that apartment,
mm-hmm.
a Special Forces guy gave me a great big Viet Cong flag.
Right.
Which I really was proud of. I brought it home and gave it to my brother. I don't know where it is now. But it had been... the star in the middle of it was coming loose from the thread,
mm-hmm.
and I gave it to my maid outside and told her to sew that back together.
Right.
And she was sewing it up when the police happened by and arrested her and took her off to jail,
wow.
figuring that, well, she's got the Viet Cong flag, she's a Viet Cong.
Right.
And I had to go out there and get her back and explain to them what was going on. That was kind of humorous.
Uh-huh.
While we were in C-47s in Nha Trang, it's when America, I don't know why, they got this thing that they've got to send us some food and they got to send us some letters.
Mm-hmm.
They had this big thing in the States of support your servicemen overseas.
Right.
And they were all kind of letters from girls that you'd want to answer just to say in schools. And people would send you cookies and all that stuff, you know.
Just complete strangers.
Yeah, complete strangers just trying to say, okay, I support you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, different companies would send stuff over for your unit. My roommate's father worked at the Schlitz Brewery in the States somewhere and said, hey, I'm sending you a gift over. And so one day we got a call from the base actor, and the train said, hey, you've got some stuff out here you got to come pick up. And we went out there in a pickup truck.
Right.
And he had sent us so many pallets of beer that it took us three trips out there with a pickup truck to bring it back to our house.
Wow.
It wouldn't fit in there, and we put it on the front porch.
Wow.
And it was just for us. So you can imagine for a while we had some, well, we knew that we couldn't finish all that beer, but we kept enough of it for our trip and took the rest of it downtown and sold it to the bar owners. They
uh-huh.
got a lot of money for that.
Uh-huh.
But that was kind of humorous.
That is funny. Anything else that comes to mind?
No.
Okay.
There's a million things. You just can't think of them.
Right, right. Was there a particular brave action that you remember that stands out in your mind?
Brave action?
Yes, sir.
As far as I'm concerned, I wasn't brave. No.
Okay. What about those around you? Or was there an incident that you remember?
No, there wasn't anything. I remember I tried to get a Purple Heart when I was at Pleiku one night. They mortared the airfield, and they were trying to hit our airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And they told us to get away from it, to move. And so we started running away from the airfield. And I ran into a barbed wire fence and cut my arm pretty bad.
Right.
And went over and told them that was combat, and they ought to give me a Purple Heart, but they didn't do it. So that wasn't brave. I was just running away from the airplane.
Right, right. How often did those mortar attacks or rocket attacks happen at these bases?
The bases we were at it seldom happened, but when we'd visit some of those bases, it would happen. We'd want to stay there as small a time as possible and get out of there.
Yeah.
But the ones we stayed at overnight, they were really safe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the immediate leadership that you had in Vietnam, those ranked just above you who were kind of directing your operations?
As a general rule, they were great people. There were a couple, just like you'll always have, who were lousy.
Right.
And just soon not name them. But
sure.
Overall, the leadership was real good.
What about the overall leadership for the war in general, as far as the military commanders, Westmoreland, Abrams?
Yeah. Well, now everybody knows about those and their shortfalls. But I'm going to tell you, and I do too, and there's some of them that I really can't stand. But I will tell you the truth. While I was over there, they were invisible. They meant nothing to me.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
They didn't affect anything that we were doing that I can remember.
How about some of the Air Force leaders?
Same with that. The higher up you got, the more invisible they became. Our squadron commander, who was over everything,
mm-hmm.
as a general rule, was a very nice person.
Okay.
I'm never. It's very hard to find any that were just really, really outstanding, but they did their job.
Right.
And they put the emphasis where it ought to be, which is whatever their bosses told them to do.
Did you ever come across a time when American morale was either going down or very, very high?
No. I wasn't. If I'd have been a foot soldier, it would have been a different thing. But from what we did, it was just, you're like a truck driver.
Mm-hmm.
You could care less what's going on.
How much contact did you have with the indigenous forces, the Vietnamese Air Force or ARVN?
The Vietnamese Air Force, other than when I was in Ranch Hin and they had to fly with us, and being over there close to Nguyen Cao Ky, we had a couple of them that were friends of ours, and we'd meet at bars, and we could use them to translate what some of those girls were saying to each other.
Right.
That we'd go around drinking together. They were nice, but other than that, as a general rule, we didn't have anything to do with them.
Okay. Of the three planes that you flew in, the 123, the 47, and the 130, which was your favorite?
But you're right. Those are the ones I flew. I think it has to be the 130 because it had C-130 because it had so much for the navigator to use.
Right.
I was most used to the C-123, but the C-130 was great.
Mm-hmm. Which was the worst of the three?
Of course, the C-47,
right.
It's just, it was good during the Second World War, but,
right.
We're past that now.
Right.